Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. So much to talk about, so much to get to. The possible bankruptcy of Detroit. What's that going to mean here to Harrisburg? Is this the litmus test? Is this our future here in Harrisburg and in places like Buffalo and Chicago and all across this country? We shall soon find out. Also going to talk about activism in the changing world, because it is Moral Monday. You know, as we see all of the assaults on this social safety net, all of the assaults on education and healthcare and infrastructure, all of this stuff, what can we do besides, as I know some people want to do, just throw up your hands and go, they're all corrupt. Fix it. Also more on the stand your ground, or should I say fall on the ground. We'll talk more about that. And also, we'll see what a week has uncovered as the Republicans here in Pennsylvania go poverty hunting. We'll see what that poverty hunt has netted in as they go and look and see. They're interested in poverty, so we should encourage them. Might be the first time ever. Also going to take your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. All weekend long, my head has been spinning. Have you ever had, I'm sure you've had these moments where you're sitting at a lunch counter and I was just by myself, just wanted to quick bite to eat before I went on to finish running my errands. So I'm sitting there and you're between two people who, well, they're insane. Or just plain stupid. I don't know which. But, you know, normally I keep to myself because I don't like getting involved in the, because it only turns into an argument and an ugly scene and the waitresses don't like it. So I just usually sit there and absorb. And this was one of those moments where it was clear to me. And look, I'm the kind of person who very rarely sees racism in things. You know, people say, oh, that's racist. Look, I grew up in a predominantly black neighborhood. I believe that everything comes down to economics. That's where I put my hat. Everything is poverty is not a black or a white issue. Poverty is a human issue. And a lot of what you see is poverty based. You solve the issue of poverty, you solve the issue as a whole. But the whole Zimmerman verdict was the topic of discussion between the folks at the table. And mind you, and not surprising, I was the only one who questioned the verdict. This was a moment where the handful of people who were at the diner I was at were, you know, basically screaming at the TV saying that the verdict was just and that got what he deserved and he was only defending himself. And finally I had, I just had enough. And it's not like I was bolsterous or anything. I just turned and I asked a simple question. And I said, you know, the Stand Your Ground law states that if you have a legal right to be somewhere, you don't have to retreat. You can defend yourself, right? Well, to my surprise, duh, I thought they knew that. Didn't know it. You have a legal right. So both Zimmerman and Martin had a legal right to be there. And I asked the guy, I said, okay, so you and I both sitting here, we have a legal right to be here. I point my finger in your face. You beat the living tar out of me, and I shoot you. Is that standing your ground? And which one of us get to stand and which one of us get to fall? Is the answer that the kids should have had a gun so they both shot each other? Explain to me your view on this, because I got to be honest with you. What I'm hearing sounds like your typical racist banner. They shot the kid because he was a black kid. Well, to that, there was no answer other than, well, you know, that kid beat him up. I go, yeah, because he approached the kid. He stays in his car. He doesn't start the confrontation. This doesn't happen. And I began to tell him the story, you know, like I told you guys last week. You know, I remember that. And the president said it too. He could have been him as well. Not in the same way that it was me. I mean, literally the exact same scenario. Guy jumps out of his car, he's going to beat the living tar out of me. Table turns, he's on all fours, and I'm kicking him in the behind. He could have easily turned and shot me. But I guess that was a different time. Not everybody was packing. And not everybody went with the intent that they're defending their neighborhood. And look, you know, today the big news is Zimmerman rescued people. Great. Still goes along with that mindset of wanting to be the cop, wanting to be that hero. Not surprised by it at all. And good for him. We need more people who are willing to lend a hand. My problem is we've glorified a horrible situation that started because someone thought that they had the right to stop somebody on the street. And to me, that's the point of this. To the people I was taught, I had at the lunch counter with me, they saw this as he was a thug, that kid got what he deserved, and didn't think about it from the other perspective. That, you know what? That kid had the legal right to be there as well. That's the legal right. Now, if he breaks into your house, that's a completely different thing, and I don't think anybody, or at least I doubt I would find many people who would say that you don't have the right to defend yourself and shoot somebody in your house. They're in your house. They do not have the legal right to be there, unless, of course, you let them in, which we do find occasionally has happened. But, you know, the whole weekend I was stuck thinking about this, and it was really infuriating that I've now wasted my whole weekend thinking about a couple of dimwits at a lunch counter. But the stereotypical mentality, you just go, really? I guess I was just stuck with this because when I walked away and we had had a couple of very civil toned conversations and it didn't escalate, nor would I've allowed it. I would have just walked away because, that's how I get shot. It comes down to, and I'm hoping this is what instead of it being the racist rant that I thought it was, that it's they are going to defend anything that they perceive as an attack on anyone having a gun. And I don't see it that way at all. My fear is now what happens is you end up going, well, no, everybody needs a gun because we all get, because somebody's going to stand and someone's going to fall. And I don't want it to be me. And in that scenario, I see both people being bad shots and hitting me, which is that I fall. But my hope is that's what it is. It's simply that they view any discussion about guns in the negative, and it was that. Because, you know, I began asking them about the situation of which, you know, I didn't listen to the entire trial, admittedly. I didn't spend that much time, you know, following it. I did read about the case. I did read about the stories that were available. And what I know is kids walking down the street, Zimmerman's calling the cops. Person tells him, don't go out there. Does it anyway. Confrontation ensues. Somebody's dead. To me, and you may have a different opinion, I'm curious of the thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. He doesn't get out of the car. Kid's still alive. Trial never happens. We don't waste a ton of state resource. We don't waste a ton of energy and time on this. Because for me, at the end of the day, I go back to, we need economic help. We need jobs plans. We need so much. And this was a distraction, a major distraction. And as I sit and I think about these laws, I've yet to find one of my NRA friends who thinks they're a bad idea. Until you start to put it in the other in the other frame. And I think we all need to take a step back for a second on this issue and go, okay, Zimmerman's the guy who stood trial. Let's put ourselves in the other position, which I guess I've been in the other position. I don't have to step back. Is that the society we want? Where someone now feels emboldened because they're packing heat that they can stop and question anyone? I sure hope not. Anyway, an interesting cartoon that has caught the ire of many. The Investor's Business Daily. It is obviously a business newspaper with, you know, like most business newspapers, very conservative editorial page. They, along with the conservative rag, the National Review, its online version, put out the cartoon of the day. And it's a cartoon of a big tree with four lynched people, four people hanging by the neck with a noose. And the tree they title Sharpton, and the people that are hanging have Truth on their back. And, you know, they have, you know, Tawana Brawley hoax, Crown Heights, Freddy's Fashion Mart, and Zimmerman trial. And the whole idea is to say that, you know, Al Sharpton got all worked up about the other three, which, you know, didn't turn out well. The, if I remember right, Crown Heights, was a riot, ended a riot, the Fashion Mart place. There was a shooting, and the Tawana Brawley thing was a rape hoax, that Sharpton had gotten involved in. Now, they've added the Zimmerman trial, and just to kind of minimize the importance of this, because, you know, they're attacking Sharpton and attacking anything that would take away from their messaging on this. Now, understand, the Investor's Business Daily, they've had some questionable decisions there, like when they were talking about the Affordable Care Act a couple years ago. They said that people like Stephen Hawking wouldn't have a chance in the UK, where the national health system would say the life of this brilliant man because of his physical handicap is essentially worthless. Now, understand this. Stephen Hawking lives in the UK, where the National Health Service is. He was born in England, which is in the UK. He's was a professor at the, I think he still is, professor at the University of Cambridge, in the UK. So I guess, you know, not so good on the facts, but good, really good on the riling people up. It just is what it is. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Just right. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
In Washington, D.C. Monday, American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten called on educators to join with parents and community partners nationwide to reclaim the promise of public education. She said a new poll shows parents overwhelmingly want to see strong public schools rather than charter schools, and she says parents trust and respect teachers more than the politicians and CEOs who are attacking teachers and their unions.
What parents are telling us is, wait a second, actually trust the people who are closest to our kids. Don't fire them. Turn around struggling schools and stabilize our neighborhoods. Don't close them. Parents very much want our bosses and public officials to work with teacher unions, not to keep the fight up. Parents want high quality public schools.
Weingarten says 1 in 2 public school students are impoverished. She says the American Federation of Teachers is using solution-driven unionism to make sure that teachers are prepared to meet high standards. Weingarten says the promise of a great public education is under assault by those who, for ideological reasons, want to call public education a failure. She says communities and teachers must join forces nationwide to fix not close, struggling schools. Michigan's Republican governor is appealing, but a county court in Michigan has agreed with AFSCME that Detroit's bankruptcy filing violates Michigan's state constitution by threatening to cut pension benefits. AFSCME President Lee Saunders says neither Michigan Governor Rick Snyder nor Detroit Emergency Financial Manager Kevin Orr are above the law. The county judge ruled that the emergency manager should immediately withdraw the bankruptcy petition and to not authorize any further bankruptcy filings that threaten to diminish or impair accrued pension benefits. AFSCME says Detroit's public workers get an average pension of less than $18,000 a year, and it's both illegal and unfair to cut them. The public is still finding out details regarding the fallout from a 2011 nuclear power plant meltdown in Japan. Jesse Russell reports.
10% of the emergency workers at the Fukushima nuclear plant in Japan were doused with enough radiation to potentially develop thyroid cancer. Tokyo Electric Power said last week that 1,973 emergency workers were hit with what is considered to be the tipping point of exposure by doctors. In March of 2011, reactors of the plant began to melt down due to an earthquake and tsunami. More than 18,000 died during the natural disaster that brought on the meltdown, and tens of thousands had to evacuate due to the radiation threat. This week, the company admitted that radioactive waste has likely been leaking into the sea ever since the disaster.
Workers at an Ontario-based Coca-Cola plant have ended a strike after 3 weeks. The workers are represented by the Canadian Auto Workers and returned to work following a vote in favor of a new 3-year contract. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
What keeps you up at night, Governor? What part of all of those worries concerns you the most? The cuts, the tax cuts?
Well, usually I wake up about 3 o'clock in the morning, and I wonder where we are going to balance the budget. We have a pension crisis just like every other state just about has a pension crisis.
You've had success. I want our viewers to know you've balanced 2 previous budgets, if not more. Right. Correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, you've closed deficit holes of more than $4 billion. You've had success.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So, you know, I look at this, and, you know, I've been going back through all of the discussion and all of the the thoughts on this trial. And what's infuriating to me on so many levels is that it's all been one-sided in my view. The media coverage of it. And you look at somebody like Limbaugh, who today, I understand that it's all about, hey, you know, how can I get ratings? But Limbaugh said today, if any race of people should not have guilt about slavery, it's Caucasians, because evidently, you know, white people have nothing to do with slavery. He said the white race has probably had fewer slaves and for a briefer period of time than any other in the history of the world. Well, do you know why? They're generally the ones enslaving. He went on to say, despite all that, no other race has ever fought a war for the purpose of ending slavery, which we did, he said. Nearly 600,000 people killed in the Civil War. And that's thinking that 600,000 people died to end slavery. Now, Civil War, they claimed the number was 618,222 people who died. They say 360,000 for the North, about 260,000 from the South. So of the 600,000 number that Limbaugh threw out, almost half of them were fighting to keep slavery. But yeah, facts be damned. Facts be damned, because, you know, that doesn't fit into the frame that they want. Just leaves me scratching my head. And at the end of this, you know, there are so many things that we should be doing here. There are so many things that need to be done and so many things that, I don't know, you know, I look at this whole situation, all of these laws that the ALEC people have pushed through, and I've yet to find any of them that are good for me or for you. I just haven't. And, you know, anyway, on Saturday there were a number of rallies across the country. You had, you know, hundreds and thousands of people out in the streets saying we need to look at, even John McCain came out and said that he agreed with Obama. He was on the Sunday shows saying that, you know, he agrees with it. And we do need to he said, you know, the stand your ground laws need to be reexamined nationally and in places like Arizona where he's from. Because you know, I think this is just off the wrong way. He said, what I got out of the president's statement, which I thought was very impressive, is that we need have more of a conversation in America. He says, I need to talk more of my Hispanic organizations in my state, and I need to talk to more African-American organizations. And at the end of the day, for me, it comes down to something very simple. I keep going back to the economics of this, the jobs part of it. I think a lot of problems we have come down to the economy. And what the president said is, he said that he's bouncing around some ideas with his staff on how to work on the challenges that exist for African-American males. One of his ideas, he said it would be productive for justice, governors, mayors, to work with law enforcement at the state and local level in order to reduce the kind of mistrust in the statement that sometimes currently exists. You know, how about getting rid of the for-profit prison industry that sees young black males who are at a higher rate of unemployment as cash crop for filling their prisons? How about that as an idea? The number two idea is useful to examine some state and local laws to see if they're designed in such a way that they may encourage the kinds of altercations and confrontations and tragedies that happened in Florida rather than diffuse potential altercations. Okay. He also thinks that it's time. It's a long-term project. I said we need to spend more time thinking about how do we bolster and reinforce our African-American boys. And I go back to jobs. Jobs programs. That kind of does it for me. Get people to work. Just a thought. Anyway, as we saw last week, we talked about Stevie Wonder, who said that he was boycotting any state, Florida and any other state, that has the Stand Your Ground laws. A number of other artists have joined in as well. Madonna, Usher, Justin Timberlake, Rod Stewart, to name a few, Kanye West, and a number of rappers have come along as well. In fact, what they're saying is, you know, according to one report, a number of shows have already been canceled in Florida because, you know, is what it is. This is their way of standing in protest, and I'm all in favor of it. I think it's about time. Here in Harrisburg, there was a one of the rallies as well. There were a bunch of people out in the streets as well. This is one of those moments where you go, you know, I've been talking about this for about a week and a half now, and I really don't know what more this topic has other than the law is just bad. And this is, you know, for me, I go back to the whole conservative governance. What happens when you give power, really unmitigated power, to conservatives? What does it leave us with? What does the law and order state look like when you're arming, arming half the population? And, you know, I met someone recently who says, you know, and has kind of changed my thinking a little bit. That the idea should be, we should be arming the people that are being killed. Because originally, right on, I asked the question, what would have happened if Martin would have had a gun? Or the threat of him having a gun? Would someone like Zimmerman be more or less likely to jump out of the car and go begin an altercation? And I'm kind of rethinking my thought on that. Not that I'm in favor of it, not that I think it's a good idea, but I'm in that thought process. Well, you know, if the kid had a gun, you know, could he have defended himself? Because I think I'm stuck on that. And I've yet to have anybody who's been able to pull me out for that point. The kid had a legal right to be there. And if he had a legal right to be there as the law is written, well, he has a legal right to defend his turf, which is where his feet are, right? I mean, isn't that the way the law is written? Why should he have to run? Why should he have to not defend himself? I guess I'm just caught on that. That's one of those moments where you go, now, I don't want everybody walking around with sidearms, because I know that leads to trouble as well. I'm not sure. You know, I guess it is what it is. And for me, the more time I spend thinking about this, the more frustrated I get. Because if you remember back when we were here in Pennsylvania, they were ramming through the Castle Doctrine and these laws were being passed, I was saying there's trouble in the works. Now, Pennsylvania's law isn't as expansive as the Stand Your Ground law, but it's, you know, if you're sitting in your car, if you're in your backyard, yeah, there's more. It's been expanded. It's not this. The Stand Your Ground thing is anywhere, wherever your feet are. That's where you don't have to run. And I gotta be honest, I'm of the mindset that you get away first. If there's nowhere to go and you're backed into a corner, you obviously defend yourself with whatever means necessary. But this idea that we can now stir stuff up and shoot our way out of it. I mean, because think about it. Put yourself in that position. How many times during the day does somebody infringe on your personal space? And you go, oh, that was, you know, I didn't like that. Imagine someone coming up to you and what are you doing? Where are you going? Why are you here? I mean, I said last week, I would tell you to go pound sand. Or probably a little more direct. And then over the weekend, I was thinking about, a couple of years ago, I was at the bank and a guy recognized me from doing this show. And this was, I guess this was probably 7 years ago when this happened, because we were in the middle of the anti-war stuff. And I said, you know, because I was against the wars. And I guess this meant to this guy who was, I guess, a listener at the time, and that I was a pacifist. And, you know, at the time, you know, I'm 6'3". At the time, I was probably going about 3 1/4". I was a pretty sizable human being. And this was a little guy. I mean, probably no more than 5'6", 5'7", maybe, you know, 170. Poking me in the chest in the parking lot. Thinking that, you know, he's a pacifist. He's not going to do anything back. And I had to explain to him. I will beat you within an inch of your life. You don't touch me. Now I'm thinking that situation through because he had the prerequisite gun rack. You know, he starts a fight with me, I beat the tar out of him, he shoots me. That's now what can happen. Because as I'm thinking this scenario through, I'm the much bigger guy, so naturally he's going to claim, I feared for my life, even though he started it. Do you see what we've opened up? I mean, cheer for your side if you have to. Cheer for the white guy. Cheer for the guy with the gun. Cheer for however you have to justify it. But think about it in the bigger picture. That's what concerns me. Pretty simple as far as I see it. Anyway, I'm going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red. Rick Smith.
Stop paying high interest rates for the promise of small rewards. Get the PSECU Visa card instead. No games, no gimmicks. Just a low 9.9 annual percentage rate. Then get the greatest reward of all, paying less for the things you want. PSECU, financing life is what we do best.
GCU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pseccu.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal Opportunity Lender.
One thing I've come to value in the last couple of years is the altruism and keen economic insights of the fourth richest man in America, Charles Koch. Even though Koch was raised rich and has now amassed a personal fortune of about $34 billion, he recently gave us a deeper sense of his true worth, measured not in dollars but in values. We want to do a better job of raising up the disadvantaged and the poorest in this country, he declared. Excellent thought. FDR couldn't have put it better. Noting that a big problem for the poor is that the powers that be, quote, keep throwing obstacles in their way, Koch cut to the chase, saying, we've got to clear those out. Yes, Charlie, I'm with you. Clear out such barriers as the offshoring of middle-class jobs, union busting, poorly funded schools, and lack of affordable health care, housing, and child care. Good God, no, barked Koch. It turns out that he intends to help poor people by eliminating, ready, the minimum wage. Why? Because, explains this clueless son of the rich, having a wage floor, quote, reduces the mobility of labor. In case you don't dwell in the plutocratic, narcissistic, Ayn Randian fantasy land where the Kochs hang out, labor mobility is right-wing psychobabble for social Darwinism. Remove all remnants of America's economic safety net, they coldly theorize, while wallowing in their nests of luxury, and the poor will be freed to become billionaires. As Charles puts it, with no protections, the disadvantaged would have to scramble just to live, thus freeing them to, quote, start a business, drive a taxi cab, become a hairdresser. This is Jim Hightower saying, what a visionary he is. Where you see massive, debilitating poverty, he sees a brave new world with millions of billionaire hairdressers. And the Kochs wonder why they're considered kooks.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Right now, we are hard at work to bring a major natural gas processing plant to southwestern Pennsylvania. The best argument we can make to the company behind the project is Pennsylvania's embrace of free markets.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. You know, last Monday on the Capitol steps, House Majority Policy Committee Chairman Dave Reed announced the committee's plan for a listening tour. Yes, the Republicans were going to take it to the road. They were going to go out into the Commonwealth and see what poverty looks like. And I chuckled back then when I saw it, because they have come out with their empowering opportunities, gateways out of poverty. Now, look, I'm in no way against any idea that's going to alleviate poverty, but I think we've seen their ideas. I'll be honest, I'm kind of hopeful. I'm hopeful that you're going to get a bunch of these pampered legislators, these well-heeled, well-funded legislators to go out into the, and I'm hoping they will. I'm hoping that this is actually something that they will do other than talk about. To this point, haven't seen anything. And we were supposed to have a state rep on to tell us about what they've been doing. That didn't happen. So we're going to try again later in the week. But I'm curious, where are they going to visit? What places are they going to visit? And what are they expecting to find? And what are they going to do about it? So let's say you go into one of these housing projects and you find abject poverty. You find lack of hope, lack of opportunity. You find broken homes and broken communities. What do you do? you know, I look at this, and as I said, you know, this guy is, he's going to go around and we're going to see what poverty looks like. And is it going to be more of the same? Is it going to be more, hey, we need to cut, gut, and punish? Is it going to be more screw quester? Is that what we're looking for? I really want to know what their plans are. Where's the listening tour going to take us? Because what I've seen is I've seen them wanting to gut food stamps. In fact, on the national level, they've taken it completely out of the farm bill. So rich people welfare, good. Poor people welfare, bad. At least that's the messaging I get. And as I said, we saw this. I want to know what the empowering opportunities gateway out of poverty is. And we've got Pennsylvania State Representative Kevin Boyle on the line. He is a member of Pennsylvania's Policy Committee. Kevin, thanks for taking time for us and being here.
Sure, anytime, Rick.
I'm curious, you know, as a member of the Policy Committee, I'm sure you know that Chairman Reid has laid out, this plan. I'm curious what the great details are and where they plan to visit and, you know, and what they're going to see as they look for what poverty looks like.
Well, you know what, there is just too much poverty in Pennsylvania. And I think what many Republican lawmakers might not realize is much of the poverty is in their own communities and in the heart of Pennsylvania and in the T. And so many of the programs that they cut were by not opting into expanding Medicaid as part of Obamacare. By choosing to do that, they're only making poverty a worse issue in Pennsylvania.
So I'm sure that they've put out their kind of an idea, a basis of what they want to do. And I'm sure the Republicans are working hand in hand with Democrats because now they've come to this moment where poverty they see as a problem, right?
Well, at least they're aware that there is a problem. I can't say that they've, you know, been working with us directly on some sort of mass strategy to combat poverty. But I would certainly welcome working with Republican lawmakers to combat, you know, the greatest moral issue in our country.
Yeah, because I look at this, Kevin, and I go, you know, the very people who, in my view, and you don't have to come with me on this, but in my view, the people who have pushed the policies that have made poverty that much worse, freezing unemployment for the next decade so that it's eroded by inflation, eliminating the general assistance budget, all of the cuts to health and human services, all of the cuts to education. I'm sorry, to me, and you may not agree with me, but to me, all of those things make poverty worse.
Now, I 110% agree with you, Rick. This Tom Corbett regime, this Republican majority in the state legislature, they made a bad situation which emanated from the Great Recession and the deregulation of the financial sector. They made a bad situation worse. That's why we're 46 in job creation, because these terrible budgets just took out funding for education. So there were teachers laid off, teachers that once were making $50,000, $60,000 a year. Some of them are now just making ends meet at Walmart or other minimum wage jobs. So just the quality of jobs, even the jobs that people are now getting in Pennsylvania, they've gone from family-sustaining jobs to jobs that just get people by, and they're barely above the poverty line.
Yeah, one of the few things I agreed with former President Reagan about was he said the best anti-poverty program is a job, and I absolutely agree with that. So my question then becomes, why can't we get a transportation bill, and why is it that the people who told us in 2010 that laser-like focus on jobs, I've seen nothing come out of the Republicans on the state level or the national level on the jobs front, and, you know, is it going to be another 5-10 years before we see a transportation bill that's going to invest in Pennsylvania?
You know what? I don't know how long it will be, but it's certainly not because of the Democratic minority, as Mike Terzai and some of his staffers and his top lieutenants blame the Democrats for. The reason why there's not a transportation bill is because of the Republican majority, and frankly, it's because of the Grover Norquist pledge.
Yeah.
You had maybe a majority of the Republican delegation from the T has signed on to the Grover Norquist pledge, and it's an absolutely irresponsible pledge that fundamentally does not provide for what government's always been about, which is providing roads so goods can get from farms to the marketplace. And this is a historic precedent that we've always funded transportation. Now we've seen such a radical departure from what was, you know, sort of typical conservative economic views to a very, very hard, radical conservative economic line that is just about no new taxes of any sort.
Well, I think it's no taxes at all. The wealthy in this country, they've gotten theirs, and screw the rest of us. That seems to be the mentality and the mantra that I'm getting. Hooray for me and the hell with the rest of you.
Yeah, I agree. And I think ultimately what it gets to, it's rooted in psychology. And this Republican majority has the mindset, unfortunately, of too many Americans where they just don't relate to their fellow Americans. And you know, they don't want to do anything that could possibly help people. And it's unfortunate. We are where we are as a country, not because we retreated from helping one another, but because of great programs by great leaders like FDR. And every passing year, this Republican majority tries to bring us backwards.
Now, taking this back to the good old days of the 80s and 90s, the 1880s and 1890s. You know, I look at this, and, you know, as a member of the reason I ask, and I've emphasized this as a member of the policy committee, have they shared with you any of the idea? Because when I first read this, when I first read Chairman Reid's initiative, this Empowering Opportunities initiative, Gateways Out of Poverty, when I first read this, I said a couple of things. First, I hope they're not being disingenuous. I believe they are, but I hope they're not. I hope they will really go into poverty-ridden areas and they will see what poverty looks like and see the conditions that I grew up under as a kid, growing up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland. I hope they go into these neighborhoods and really do the due diligence that I think is necessary. And I hope that they come up with some rational ideas. So I'm curious, in your committee, Have they told you about this? Because I got to be honest, when I called your office, they didn't know about it.
The first I heard about it was when you contacted my office this afternoon to appear tonight. So I can't say that it's been a regular talking point of the Republican state legislators that they interact with. And I share your sentiments. I hope they do take a legitimate look at poverty and its true causes. Too often I see when conservatives talk about poverty and solving poverty issues, they make it out to be poverty is caused by the moral failings of the impoverished. And I think the real culprit behind poverty is the scarcity of good jobs. And the best way to tackle poverty is to get those family-sustaining jobs that my dad was able to get for himself, even with an eighth grade education. And, every passing year, those good union jobs are, there are much fewer, there are many fewer of them.
Yeah, as we see globalization and the pressures of the quote-unquote free market, or as I call it, the poor market, getting weighed down on working families. You know, the reason I asked the question, though, and I was very direct about it, is, and I got the answer I wanted, you didn't know, because they didn't tell anybody on the Democratic side, is because that idea of blaming Democrats for their transportation bill is absolutely ludicrous. And only in conservative Terzai world, only in Republican world would that math add up. Because, as I understand it, and again, maybe I'm wrong, the Democrats really don't even have to show up, because the Republicans have absolute steamroller capabilities. They have absolute power.
Yeah, they could have nine House Republicans not vote for transportation and still get this passed without any Democrats whatsoever. So to blame the Democrats is ridiculous. It's my understanding that a week before the budget was due, messengers from Terzai came to the Democratic leader's office and said they needed about 60 to 70 Democratic votes for a transportation bill. So they needed basically over two-thirds of the Democratic caucus. And we would certainly put up those votes to get transportation done if the transportation bill was a bill that fully funded mass transit in southeastern PA and also the Port Authority in Pittsburgh. But it wasn't. It was not a good bill. It wasn't a bill worthy of our support in the Democratic delegation. But if there is a good bill that is worthy of our support, we'll absolutely 100% be willing to support a transportation bill, because fundamentally we need to rebuild our aging infrastructure in Pennsylvania, and we also need to put as many hardworking tradesmen and women back into work in Pennsylvania.
Absolutely, I agree with you. But I look at this and as I listen to the messaging behind it, and you're right, they needed all those votes from Democrats because the Republicans believed it was a bad piece of legislation. And for me, if you'd have voted for it, it would have just said they would have saddled the see what bad legislation the Democrats brought us.
This is
how it works, man.
Yeah.
So let me ask you, I want to go back to this poverty initiative, because, you know, we hear an awful lot from the conservatives about family values. And I don't know if you saw the big news today. The baby came, evidently Princess Kate or whatever she is. Had the baby. You want to talk about real family values? The Prince William there, he's going to get paid maternity leave. To me, that's a family value. Why can't Republicans talk about that? That would help families, wouldn't it?
Well, I agree with you, and I think, unfortunately, so many times European countries have beaten us, whether it be a 21st century transportation system where you see high-speed rail in Europe, where you can go from, you know, Munich to Berlin in about half the time than you used to. And many other European countries are benefiting from mass transit, and also family medical leave, which I don't think is socialism or communism or any other term that they would use to demonize just pure, simple family values.
How much do you think of this initiative, if anything comes out of it, is just going to be demonizing and blaming people for being in this position we're in? I mean, you know, we see a lot of the pundits, the Ted Nugents of the world, and the extremists that have infected the Republican Party, going and pointing blame at those who are affected. I mean, our own governor blaming the unemployed, calling them lazy and stupid and drugs and all of that stuff. How much do you think is going to devolve into, well, you're poor, you're in poverty because of you?
That would be my biggest fear, because my suspicion, which is based off of precedent, is that you'll see a lot of that. And it's unfortunate, and it just really misses the mark. And it doesn't get to just the fundamental reason for poverty, which is a scarcity of good jobs. The, often conservative critics of poverty, they devote so much time to issues like welfare fraud, and they're so obsessed with a poor woman, maybe in inner city Philadelphia, who might be taking $100 more in benefits than she should. Meanwhile, a corporate raider, an executive, is just committing tax fraud or getting away with tax loopholes that cost millions of dollars to the coffers of the state of Pennsylvania. I think it's an odd and perverse obsession we have with the least powerful amongst us.
Well, I think a lot of that has to do with we identify and we see that woman in front of us using the EBT card, or we think we know somebody who's cheating the system. I hear the anecdotal stories, and I'm sure you do too as a state representative. I'm sure you hear the stories all the time, yet nobody can A, back them up, or B, if they do know somebody, willing to turn them in. And I got it on my speed dial. I'm like, okay, well, you know somebody who's cheating? Let's turn them in, because that's not
right.
What the system's supposed to do.
Yeah. Well, it's amazing. It's in many ways it's become racialized as well, and that's unfortunate. And we as a society must do better.
Yeah, I agree. You know, and I look at it, you know, I look at the farm bill, for instance. You know, at the beginning I was saying, you know, the Republicans want to make sure that the Monsantos and the Cargills and these huge multinational agribusinesses, they get their welfare. But heaven forbid we give food stamps to poor kids, you know, kids like me when I was growing up. I mean, they're literally taking food out of the mouths of children so they can give resources to, I think it was 74% of all of the subsidies that go to the farmers go to four companies. I mean, to me, that's massive welfare fraud.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, I think we, as Democrats, we do the country a disservice by not being more aggressive in talking about this issue, that the issue being corporate welfare, because I think a massive mobilizer of Republican votes, conservative votes, is built around this notion of a society of spongers. I think it's what Mitt Romney was talking about. And frankly, in my working class district, I think so many people are Republicans, even though they should be Democrats on economic lines, because they feel as though they're just a mass number of spongers who are just raiding their hard-earned tax dollars. And what's reality is that, meanwhile, you know, there certainly are people in welfare who shouldn't be on welfare, but the people that are really stealing money are not the impoverished women in inner city Philadelphia. It's the people on Wall Street. Not all people, but certainly so many corporations take full benefit of tax loopholes that should not be there.
And they lobby for them, and they spend lots of money to get them, which is why I wanted to see Mitt Romney's tax return. Not because I think he did anything wrong. I think what he did was probably perfectly legal, but I'd like to evaluate how much money did we give him? How many tax loopholes did he take advantage of? And are they beneficial? Are they good for our economy? Are they good for our nation?
Yeah. No, and he never released his taxes. And I think we can conjecture on why that was. I have my opinions on where he put a lot of his money that he wanted to hide to avoid American taxes. And, thank God he's not our president.
Oh, say it isn't so. He didn't hide money in the Caymans and in Switzerland. Oh, wait a minute. Yes, he did. Sorry. but, you know, here's the thing. And, you know, I go back to this poverty thing. Last Monday, as well as announcing their big initiative, working on the payday lending thing. And I want to talk a bit about that, because to me, that shows me the anti-poverty programs that they're willing to go after, our Republican friends. We'll give them payday lending so they can pay 369% interest on a $50 loan. That sounds like a good anti-poverty program, no?
Well, all we need to know about payday lending is that the U.S. military has been very aggressive in the last few years trying to kick out payday lenders from U.S. military bases, because it's lending that is very, very unfair to the consumer. And the consumer in this case is nearly always the poor or the working poor.
You know, when I was a kid, they had a name for it. It was called loan sharking.
Yeah.
And it was illegal then.
Right.
And now we're institutionalizing it, and we've got the Republican Party here in Pennsylvania wanting to completely legalize and make loan sharking okay.
Well, fortunately, it was taken out of the fiscal code that we passed for the second time just last Monday. The Senate found it and took it out, and then we affirmed that vote last Monday. So it's not law in Pennsylvania right now. Unfortunately, it did pass the PA House last term, but it did not pass the Senate, and hopefully it will not pass when we come back in the fall.
So was the budget passed on time?
Certainly not all of it. So I can't say, I don't think they can say they got the budget passed on time. You got to get it all done, not come back two weeks later to get it done.
How much did that cost us, the taxpayers, by not having it done on time and making them all come back?
Well, when we're in session,
I mean, because you weren't in session, were you? I mean, you had to make a special trip back for that, didn't you?
Yeah, and it depends on how many legislators stayed overnight. I didn't stay overnight. You know, some legislators taken overnight.
No, because I just don't want to hear it again. I don't want to hear, wow, we passed the budget 3 years in a row. No, you didn't. I had to pay extra. I had to pay over for something you should have done in the amount of time that you should have had to. And if you've got steamroller power, I don't understand how you not get it done.
That mistake. You mentioned the financial cost. I'm surprised the media hasn't seized upon that. That costs Pennsylvania taxpayers at least tens of thousands of dollars by us having to come back, staff having to come back, and it was just an unnecessary cost.
Exactly. And you know what that tens of thousands of dollars could have done? Could have funded anti-poverty programs like the general assistance budget or health and human services, maybe education, maybe an after-school program. I could think of tons of things we should be doing rather than that.
Right. Now, I agree 110%. And Representative Reed, who's the main proponent of this Republican look at poverty, he's also the main sponsor of a bill we passed last term, which is supposed to solve the Delaware loophole, but really doesn't. And if we ever did solve the Delaware loophole and just got rid of it for corporations who just avoid our corporate tax in Pennsylvania by setting up a P.O. box in Wilmington, Delaware, we would generate as much as $300 million a year. Think of what we could do with that $300 million a year. If we had put a proper tax on Marcellus Shale, not a 1% extraction fee, if we had gone conservative on this issue and put the same tax that Texas has, which is West Virginia, 3.5%. Is it the lowest rate anywhere except for us? If we had just gone at 3.5%, that would generate nearly an extra $500 million
Pennsylvania. What does that say about us when we're pulling West Virginia down? I mean, really?
And Texas is near 5%. So that bastion of liberalism in the Lone Star State, they have what our critics on the conservative side of the argument would say is that they would have a job-killing tax level, but certainly their natural gas industry and their oil industry in general has flourished.
If they're here drilling, the tax rate doesn't matter. If they're getting what they can get for the gas, they've already planned it into their business plan. That's the thing that blows my mind. And we're giving that to them so they can have more profit. That's what it amounts to. Bottom line.
Yep.
Last question
yep.
I've got for you. You know, in the fall, you guys are going to be coming back. What's on the agenda?
Well, I think you will see transportation again because the heavy hitters in the Republican Party, some of the big donors that they're based in the Southeast, they certainly do want a transportation bill of some sort because there are people that will benefit from it. And I do think there are many Republicans that do recognize that it has to be done.
Yeah, when a bridge is collapsing, it doesn't matter if you're a Democrat or Republican.
Yeah.
The bridge is still collapsing.
Right. Some of the more pragmatic, reasonable suburban Philadelphia Republicans recognize this, but there are many, many Republicans who don't, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's just a sad thing. Well, we'll be following it as it happens, but my problem is another construction season lost. Representative Boyle, it's always great talking with you. I appreciate your time.
Absolutely, Rick. Good talking to you.
Thanks so much. Quick break. Back with hour two of the program. If you missed any portion of the Rick Smith Show, download the podcast there at therickssmithshow.com or Stitcher. Right back, hour two. Stick around.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
In Washington, D.C. Monday, American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten called on educators to join with parents and community partners nationwide to reclaim the promise of public education. She said a new poll shows parents overwhelmingly want to see strong public schools rather than charter schools, and she says parents trust and respect teachers more than the politicians and CEOs who are attacking teachers and their unions.
What parents are telling us is, wait a second, actually trust the people who are closest to our kids. Don't fire them. Turn around struggling schools and stabilize our neighborhoods. Don't close them. Parents very much want our bosses and public officials to work with teacher unions, not to keep the fight up. Parents want high-quality public schools.
Weingarten says 1 in 2 public school students are impoverished. She says the American Federation of Teachers is using solution-driven unionism to make sure that teachers are prepared to meet high standards. Weingarten says the promise of a great public education is under assault by those who, for ideological reasons, want to call public education a failure. She says communities and teachers must join forces nationwide to fix
not close, struggling schools. Michigan's Republican governor is appealing, but a county court in Michigan has agreed with AFSCME that Detroit's bankruptcy filing violates Michigan's state constitution by threatening to cut pension benefits. AFSCME President Lee Saunders says neither Michigan Governor Rick Snyder nor Detroit Emergency Financial Manager Kevin Orr are above the law. The county judge ruled that the emergency manager should immediately withdraw the bankruptcy petition and should not authorize any further bankruptcy filings that threaten to diminish or impair accrued pension benefits. AFSCME says Detroit's public workers get an average pension of less than $18,000 a year, and it's both illegal and unfair to cut them. The public is still finding out details regarding the fallout from a 2011 nuclear power plant meltdown in Japan. Jesse Russell reports.
10% of the emergency workers at the Fukushima nuclear plant in Japan were doused with enough radiation to potentially develop thyroid cancer. Tokyo Electric Power said last week that 1,973 emergency workers were hit with what is considered to be the tipping point of exposure by doctors. In March of 2011, reactors of the plant began to melt down due to an earthquake and tsunami. More than 18,000 died during the natural disaster that brought on the meltdown, and tens of thousands had to evacuate due to the radiation threat. This week, the company admitted that radioactive waste has likely been leaking into the sea ever since the disaster.
Workers at an Ontario-based Coca-Cola plant have ended a strike after 3 weeks. The workers are represented by the Canadian Auto Workers and returned to work following a vote in favor of a new 3-year contract.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Organizing America, 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
And the radio is in the hands of such a lot of fools trying to anesthetize the way that you
check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. A friend of mine gave me a book called Strategy and Soul, A Campaigner's Tale of Fighting Billionaires, Corrupt Officials, and Philadelphia Casinos, written by a guy named Daniel Hunter, because I remember this campaign from the beginning, not a fan of the casinos. Understood, you know, like a lot of people, we're building something. It means short-term jobs. It means some type of activity. So I saw both sides of it. But I remember the campaign, and I remember the call for, hey, well, let people decide. So Daniel, the author of the book, I got on the line. He was one of the organizers, one of the lead people of the campaign to let people decide, and I guess against the casinos. We'll talk to Daniel. Daniel, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks so much. It's great to be on the program with you.
You know, I remember this back during the Rendell years where they were pushing for the casinos, and because we were told that's how we're going to balance our budgets and that's how we're going to get people back to work. And to be honest, the rhetoric sounded pretty good.
Oh, man, they did a good sales job, didn't they? They certainly tried to make the argument.
And what they did a masterful job, I thought, of doing is pitting people against one another, so you had natural friction between classes of people and neighbors. I mean, it was really a very good sales job.
It was a great sales job, and what they tried to do is really pit, as you say, pit workers against each other. So in Philadelphia, the longshoremen, for example, were very opposed to the casinos because they'd be placed on the waterfront and would impact their jobs. And, of course, the building trades were saying, well, this is jobs that would be created for us, of course, short-term jobs. And then pitting against restaurants, moviegoers, movie theaters, et cetera, which are family-sustaining jobs. And those jobs were all at risk by the casinos. In fact, we've already seen in Philly having one casino that those jobs are, in fact, going down as a result of having this competition.
Now, we see the same dynamic when you're talking about the Keystone XL pipeline as well.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's almost absolutely. To me. It's not the thing. It's just their MO.
Yeah, that's right. So one reason I wrote the book around strategy and soul was I wanted to bring people into really the real deal of how do you organize in that kind of context, because it's never as simple as I've read a lot of movement history books, and oftentimes after a campaign is over, after you look at it with 20/20 hindsight, it looks as though it was always inevitable one way or another, or it looks much more simple. And I'm remembering one book I just recently read where it looked like they just kept saying that the activists always knew what was going to happen next, which that's not how organizing is.
No,
I really wanted to bring people in the real deal of how it looks like.
And I've been reading it, and I'm impressed by the detail that you go into in the day to day, and it kind of puts you right there, because a lot of us who have a little organizing background, know these conversations happen,
yeah.
Know these little things happen. So it brings the average everyday person into that where they go, wow, this is impressive.
Yeah, a lot of thought goes into it. So, one of the things that we were right from the get-go realizing was because of the way that this has been sold in Philadelphia, which is basically it was sold as it's a done deal. There's no way you can fight it. There's no way you can take it. So just roll over and take it. And we realized right from the start we've got to take on that storyline. Right from the jump, we've got to take the storyline that we can actually win this thing back. And that was almost the fight that we took on as much as any other kind of fight. And I think that's the one I keep hearing is people are hearing like school closings. I mean, just the news cycle that we just heard. It's a sort of devastating storyline that people don't see where is our agency in it. Where is it that we can make an impact? And that's the thing that we as organizers need to bring to people right from the start is here's how to do it.
And that's just not this issue. It's any issue. And what I call for is more people to be involved in the community as we're the message in this country is we're all individuals and we all cut our own deals and we all go our own path. To me, the movement forward and how we change, be it, the income, inequality, the inequality in education and, down the line is by coming together,
exactly.
Not being split further apart.
Exactly. And one of the things I love about the dynamic in the book is, so my colleague, Jeff Herhiko, his background is a straight-up organizer. I mean, he's a community organizer, comes out of Boston, and he moved to Philadelphia, and they were trying to build a 5,000-slot parlor right across from his home. Just to get a sense of what that is, that's more slot machines than in any casino in Atlantic City or Las Vegas.
Wow.
And he wasn't able to see updated site plans, traffic plans, architectural renderings. None of that was made public. The public was locked out from the get. This is that corporate government alliance. So it's not just... We're not just talking about gambling here. We're talking about state-sponsored predatory gambling. So Jethro is a straight-up community organizer. My background is direct action. So my background has been mass mobilization. How do you organize sort of almost like large direct actions and nonviolent civil disobedience? And it was a great marriage of two styles between the two of us because he, of course, was bringing what you're saying, which is how do we just get people? How do we do door knocking? Just kind of like... roots of community organizing that are just so important and also in the world of labor organizing, that same style is brought in. And my style was, as I heard the situation, I said, look, we need to change the narrative. And so I'm looking at what's the social narrative that's going on. And so how do we create action? So the first action, for example, that we did was we said, look, these documents aren't being made public. They're being kept secret. And that's a campaign that we could run. We could say, what we ended up choosing was we want all of these documents made public. And we said we want them made public by December 1st at high noon. And if they're not made public, then we will go to the Gaming Control Board offices and we will take them ourselves. We will do a nonviolent document search to release those documents. And that's the direct action to me, which is if the government won't do it, if they won't do the right thing, then we do it ourselves. And that, I think, is the heart of direct action, which is part of the approach that I brought regularly.
And does that lead you to being arrested? I mean, you see a lot of these direct actions where people get arrested and on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
I took my daughter to Fairmont, West Virginia for the mine workers rally over Patriot Coal because their
yeah.
pensions are being stolen from them
right.
By the bankruptcy courts. And I take my 11-year-old with me and she's watching these 30 people be arrested and it was planned and the whole thing. And she's going, why?
Why?
And, you have to explain that, why. You want to get this on the record. You got to get this into courts. You've got to get the news flash. There's so much to this that, the average person, isn't thinking about. But once you lay it out, it makes better sense.
And one thing that we did is we're very careful not to make the framing that we're about getting arrested, which is something that I think sometimes we can, as activists or union organizers, can, like, slide into of, like, yeah, we're going to go get an action and we're going to go get arrested. And as if that's the means, the sort of almost the ends even to itself. And what we did was we said, our action is going to be our message. We're not going to rally. We're not going to march. We're going to make our action itself be the message that we're trying to deliver. So our message was, we want these documents made public. We want to frame this thing in a bigger storyline. We want the storyline not just to be about casinos, good or bad. We want the storyline to be about democracy and citizen input.
And who could be against that?
Yeah, exactly. So we're going for a widely shared value. And so our action itself wasn't just we're going outside of the Gaming Control Board headquarters and rallying or locking ourselves down or doing a sit-in right in front of it. Our action was our message, which was our action is this document search, to go into their offices and to attempt to release them ourselves. And what that did was it made it much harder for mainstream media, who, of course, is always so hostile to civil action right from the start. I mean, they were calling our action depressing because it's a done deal, they said over and over and over again. And so they're often so hostile, but it became more challenging for them to frame us in a negative light because they had to say why was it that we were doing this particular action. And I think that's part of the heart of really high-quality direct action is when we're able to design the action in such a way so that the action itself embeds the message. And that's part of what I think we were so thoughtful at doing again and again and sort of trying to teach people. I mean, that's part of what I'm trying to do in the book is trying to teach people, how do we do that? How is it that you regularly frame your action in a way that other people can get right away what it is that you're doing?
Yeah, you know, and you bring up the negative light thing. You know, I look at Occupy as the perfect example of, on a national scale, of the national media painting it in a negative light almost from the beginning.
Yeah. So part of what we did was, as you identified right away, we occupied, to use that term, but what we did was we occupied a higher ground. And so our job was to take what's a widely shared value here that's being violated and to expose it. And we could have taken, for example, just casinos as an issue themselves. And they turns out they're not actually a revenue producer. They're not a net job creator. They're none of these things. And we could have argued those things. But we said, what's one that people can get very quickly, that they can get right away, and that we can actionalize? So it's not just that we're saying it, but we're going to actionalize it. So we created a whole timeline, in fact. So December 1st was the end of our timeline. And each week we designed some kind of action to sort of up the ante. These were like light actions, very ones that we could do with very few people. For example, one of our actions was we went down to the Gaming Control Board headquarters and we washed their windows to help them become more transparent. So it was all in the spirit of transparency and,
nice,
again, with our action. And we're showing we're light, we're not, you know, taking ourselves too seriously, which I think also helped us sidestep some of the notions of being a kind of puritanical, vibrant, passionate group of people who are sort of activists in that negative term that they try to pin us on. We're going to be light, we're going to be friendly, and we're going to do actions that were consistent with our values, which is we're the transparency people, leaving the Gaming Control Board to look more and more like who they are, which is the people who are siding with the corporations, siding with the anti-democratic forces in society.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Daniel Hunter. He's the author of Strategy and Soul, A Campaigner's Tale of Fighting Billionaires, Corrupt Officials, and Philadelphia Casinos. Let me ask you this, in the grand scheme of things, as I look back on this, and as I said at the beginning, I was not a big fan of the casinos. I did not see them as the revenue generators. They said they were going to be. All of the wild praise and all of the wild thoughts that they came up with turned out to be not so much and not so good for us. But in the grand scheme of things, you didn't win the campaign. And I hear this a lot from people who are involved in this stuff. Yeah, we did this, we did that, but we lost. Do you see this as a loss, or do you see that there were victories along the way that you could build on?
Well, there's certainly huge victories. I mean, one was we were able to kill a casino. It's the first time, actually, that I've heard of where a casino was this far along in a process and was able to be stopped. Even with the fact that they spent $60 million fighting us, they spent had almost every law firm bought out, they had hired almost every public relations firm, and yet we were still able to stop them with all their support and backing. So we were able to kill Foxwoods Casino outright, and Sugar House Casino is now a third of the size of what they wanted to be. That was the second casino located in Philly. And that one did end up getting built, but was much smaller. And also we were able to win huge extracts in terms of how it was built, both in terms of some of the relationships to the community members and also to the riverfront itself, which was a big issue for us. So it was a huge win, actually. And in the scheme of things, one thing that it did was the casino industry itself and some of their sort of trade magazines talked about Philadelphia as a real important learning for the casino industry. One as never real hesitation to go back and do this in urban areas. Philadelphia had been a real test case in terms of doing it at a large city, and it actually really chilled them on that concept. So that was another success that we had. So it wasn't just in terms of the Philly context, but also in the national context.
So do you see the casino movement, do you see this as a racial issue? I know some people have said that they wanted to locate it in Philadelphia and in more poverty-ridden areas. Thoughts?
I think it's racial. I think it's also really about class. I think of casinos as they're actually the most effective mechanism that I know of to move money from poor and working people to rich people. I mean, all these casino investors are billionaires, millionaires, and they're able to extract huge amounts of resources from our communities. So I think of it as largely around a class thing, which is what we're seeing is these casinos, all the casino locations in Philadelphia were all residential neighborhoods. They were all located in working class neighborhoods and poor neighborhoods. And one was a particularly African-American neighborhood, others were more mixed racially, but it was all targeted towards how can we locate these things in places where people are feeling desperate, because desperation is part of their game. I mean, one reason we call them predatory gambling is these things are trying to, literally in their language, they talk about trying to play people to extinction to get every dollar that they own out of them. That's how this industry works. And a big part of it is it gets 90% of its income from 10% of their customer base.
Wow.
So it's looking at huge addiction. I mean, addiction is part of their profit.
But Daniel, they run those commercials that say if you have an addiction problem, we'll help. Right?
Yeah, it's just an amazing joke that they continue to do that. They've done the research that it's not a big effect.
I mean, the Maytag man is looking at the guy at the addiction hotline going, nothing for you either?
For every addict in Pennsylvania, the state of Pennsylvania spends about $15 in any kind of help for them. Almost, it's pittance.
It's almost nothing.
Pittance. So,
at the end of the day, Daniel, at the end of the day, Sheldon Adelson isn't sitting on over $25 billion because the casinos are losing.
Well, this is the fight. This is where we are, right, in our country right now, which is we've got to teach people how to strategize. I mean, the reason I call my book Strategy and Soul is because I want people to learn strategy and to bring our soul into this work, because it's not enough just for us to be willing to be okay with just the wins that we've got to keep getting for bigger and bigger and bigger. And one thing that I think keeps killing us is in our movements when we tell each other that we can only win what we only should take on what's winnable. And that was one of my biggest frustrations in the campaign early on, was even some of my best friends who I'd worked with, been union organizers in for years, told me, you can't win this, don't take it on. And if that's the case, our country is in a very bad shape.
I agree.
So we have to be able to take on some of these big things that at the moment look unwinnable. And the thing that I do in my book is talk about how do is it that we take one unwinnable case and win it? Because if we don't tell those stories of how do we win an unwinnable context, no one else is going to do it for us.
Yeah,
is Time Magazine going to do it? Is, you know, Philip Inquirer going to do it? Absolutely not.
And I look at the most recent movement that I'm seeing spring up is around this insane Stand Your Ground legislation and these laws around the country. And over the weekend, people were out in the streets. I'm a big fan of people in the streets. Are you a fan of rallies and protests like that, or are you more of the direct action guy?
I'm always a fan when people are in motion. I am such a believer of people being in motion. So I'd much rather people in motion than not. And early on in our campaign, we created a rule that a little bit unique, which was we will not do marches or rallies. And the reason isn't because I'm actually opposed to marches or rallies per se, but there's a way in which we've gotten so rote about it. It's almost so ritualized that both our own people don't always take us seriously, and other people who are observing the action don't necessarily take us seriously. And so one reason I started to create this rule, no marches, no rallies, is I wanted us to stay in our creativity as a movement, and to not just go for the lowest common denominator actions just because it was available to us, but to take on more and more creativity. And so that rule actually enabled us to step outside of the what we had always done over and over and over again to instead vast creativity. I mean, the actions that are in the book are just scattered with things we'd never heard of. And we kept, that was one of our rules that we wanted to go for was, let's do an action that people have never heard of before. Washing windows, non-bound document search. Let's go for we are not scared of stunts actions and Philly's ballot box. We just had great fun doing it. And I think part of it was it both invites creativity, playfulness, and it also does another thing, which is our opponents have studied us, and they're used to, even expect in some cases, that style. And one value of the kind of direct actions that I kept proposing was, let's stay outside of our opponent's experience, because they already know how to handle that. Yeah. They expected that there would be some rallies and marches, then some articles get written, and then heat blows over. We wanted to stay on what are the scripts that they haven't seen before. They never had anybody come and try to take documents from their office before in this way. And the result of it was they were unstable. They'd made foolish moves, and we were able to exploit those. And so one way I think of it is, if we're outside of our comfort zone and doing things that we haven't done before, it's more likely that our opponents, too, are outside of their comfort zone. And that's actually where we need them to be. They're used to this. We need to figure out how to adapt and change our tactics up.
I'm with you. The book is Strategy and Soul, A Campaigner's Tale for Fighting Billionaires, Corrupt Officials, and Philly Casinos, written by Daniel Hunter. Where's the best place to get your book from?
Best place is www.strategyandsoul.org.
And we'll make sure we get a link at therickSmithShow.com. Just click on Daniel Hunter's name. Daniel, it was great talking with you.
Great talking with you,
I appreciate
Rick.
Thank
your
time. The third person to email me gets a copy of Daniel Hunter's book, Strategy and Soul. Going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Stop paying high interest rates for the promise of small rewards. Get the PSECU Visa card instead. No games, no gimmicks. Just a low 9.9 annual percentage rate. Then get the greatest reward of all, paying less for the things you want. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit psecu.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal Opportunity Lender.
One thing I've come to value in the last couple of years is the altruism and keen economic insights of the fourth richest man in America, Charles Koch. Even though Koch was raised rich and has now amassed a personal fortune of about $34 billion, he recently gave us a deeper sense of his true worth, measured not in dollars but in values. We want to do a better job of raising up the disadvantaged and the poorest in this country, he declared. Excellent thought. FDR couldn't have put it better. Noting that a big problem for the poor is that the powers that be, quote, keep throwing obstacles in their way, Koch cut to the chase, saying, we've got to clear those out. Yes, Charlie, I'm with you. Clear out such barriers as the offshoring of middle-class jobs, union busting, poorly funded schools, and the lack of affordable health care, housing, and child care. Good God, no, barked Koch. It turns out that he intends to help poor people by eliminating, ready, the minimum wage. Why? Because, explains this clueless son of the rich, having a wage floor, quote, reduces the mobility of labor. In case you don't dwell in the plutocratic, narcissistic, Ayn Randian fantasy land where the Kochs hang out, labor mobility is right-wing psychobabble for social Darwinism. Remove all remnants of America's economic safety net, they coldly theorize, while wallowing in their nests of luxury, and the poor will be freed to become billionaires. As Charles puts it, with no protections, the disadvantaged would have to scramble just to live, thus freeing them to, quote, start a business, drive a taxi cab, become a hairdresser. This is Jim Hightower saying, what a visionary he is. Where you see massive, debilitating poverty, he sees a brave new world with millions of billionaire hairdressers. And the Kochs wonder why they're considered kooks. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Rebuilding America. The Rick Smith Show.
The walls came down.
Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Interesting segment, and really an interesting book. He's one of the guys I wouldn't mind sitting down picking his brain about the direction of things that we should be going with a lot of the battles I see coming in the future. There's a lot of opportunity to organize around certain issues. I mean, when the privatization thing is huge, the insane free trade agreements, more opportunity. And it's something I think you need to localize and bring down to community level where everybody in every community across the country has the ability to partake in some type of action. To me, the trade deal that's going on right now that nobody knows about, I generally take these little polls where I'll go, hey, have you heard of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement? People look at me and go, what are you talking about? The TPP, it's coming, man. What? What's that? TP? TP? Oh, I got enough TP at home. But the reality is, these free trade agreements, these agreements that we've made in the interests of the well-to-do at the expense of you and me, have destroyed our middle class. Have massively redistributed income. And what's interesting to me, as you look at the Tea Party people who've been fed this kind of red meat, and they go out there and they blame someone else, and it's all designed to pit us against one another. The whole idea is to keep two guys at a lunch counter looking at each other with a jaundiced eye and ready to go battle and ready to fight each other right there over nonsense, over things that harm both of them. I mean, that's the thing that really blows my mind in all of this. So when I got this book, I was like, well, this is a guy I got to talk to because, we've got a lot of lessons to learn in the coming years. And I don't know that we have that much time. And as I look at, the casino fight that he talked about, I was one of the people, much to probably his chagrin and mine as well, as I thought it was hopeless. And to be honest, I thought it was a loss. I haven't gotten to the end of the book yet, but they still built casinos. The moneyed interest still won out. They had to give a couple of concessions, but they still got what they wanted. And in the end, they usually do. Because we are so easily divided. To me, that's the problem. And I go back to my grandparents' generation, to where there were some basic truths. And privatization wasn't one of them. They had seen that. They had been from that world. They had been from the corporate ownership and business friendly. Didn't work. Anyway, gotta take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people on the talk.
Smith Show.
It was 75 years ago that Capital Blue Cross officially opened for business. From our earliest days, serving our customers has been at the heart of everything we do. Together, we've lived history and made history. And we're here to help guide you as we navigate a new era in healthcare together. Explore affordable health insurance options and use our free online tools to search for a provider, look up treatment costs, and more. All at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, celebrating 75 years of service. Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
We live in an island of stars called the Milky Way, and many know that our Milky Way is a spiral galaxy.
In fact, it's a barred spiral galaxy, which means that our galaxy probably has just two major spiral arms, plus a central bar that astronomers are only now beginning to understand. But where within this vast and intricate spiral structure do our sun and its planets reside?
Our galaxy is about 100,000 light-years wide, and we're about 25,000 light-years from the center of the galaxy. It turns out we're not located in one of the Milky Way's two major spiral arms. Instead, we're located in a minor arm of the galaxy. Our local spiral arm is sometimes called Orion Arm.
Our local Orion Arm of the Milky Way is about 3,500 light-years across and is approximately 10,000 light-years long. Our Sun, the Earth, and all the other planets in our solar system reside within this Orion Arm. We're located close to the inner rim of this spiral arm, about halfway along its length.
The Orion Arm is named for the constellation Orion the Hunter, which is one of the most prominent constellations of Northern Hemisphere winter or Southern Hemisphere summer. That's why we see so many bright objects within the constellation Orion, because when we look at it, we're looking at our own local spiral arm. We have a picture of this at earthsky.org. Search for the words Orion Arm. I'm Michael Brennan.
And I'm Emily Howard. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Just when you thought it was safe, those crazy Republicans are at it again. It's time for the Rick Smith Show's Conservative Alerts.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. So if you saw over the weekend, there was John Boehner saying that, you know, hey, don't judge us on what we've done. Don't judge us on anything that we've passed. Just judge us on what we've repealed. It is what it is. Anyway, I got an email from Randall. He points out that you've got an entire lamestream media industry trying to tell us, the audience, that the boss's interests are the same as the workers' interests, and most of America has bought it. Well, I'm with you, Randall, and the sad reality is this is what happens when the wealth class own all of the media. Anyway, North Carolina, once viewed as the most moderate of southern states, has really done an about-face since 2010, as they've basically enacted the entire ALEC playbook. They've eliminated the earned income tax credit, cutting about 900,000 people off of that. Like Pennsylvania, have declined the Medicaid coverage for, I guess in North Carolina, about 500,000. Here in Pennsylvania, you're looking at about 700,000. They've dumped 170,000 unemployed workers off of the federal unemployment benefits. Now, this is a state with the fifth highest joblessness rate. They cut taxes for the very well-to-do and, you know, raise taxes on everybody else, which is what the playbook calls for. And on the education front, they cut about 30,000 kids off of the pre-K programs and gave that money, some $90 to $100 million, to a voucher program, as it appears. which is why we have asked Yvonne Brennan. She's the chair of Public Schools First North Carolina to come talk to us about what's going on there in North Carolina. Yvonne, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you for having me. This is a very critical issue in our state.
Well, it's a critical issue, I think, nationwide, because once it happens to you, it's going to happen here.
Yes. And that's exactly what a lot of people have called, I think, in calls from all over the country and even international emails of folks who are saying, you know, how can you take a state with for 30 years, Governor Hunt, Governor Perdue, Governor Easley fought very hard to make teachers a revered, respected profession, paid them fairly, gave them recognition for their masteries at skill levels, you know, cared about pre-K kids, set up more for and smart start. I mean, we were the state that everybody wanted to be until 2010.
We're an infection. Where a cancer infected the Republican Party, and they've really taken you guys, I think, in the wrong direction, as we've seen across the country in numerous states. And I look at North Carolina as, you know, like I said, you know, most people saw North Carolina as a blue southern state or a more moderate southern state. You know, what's going on?
Well, I think what you've seen is the GOP took over the House, the Senate, and the governor's office. And brought with them a very, very aggressive attack against public education. It siphoned public dollars away from our public to our public schools into private schools. We've slashed all our funds for a teacher assistant. I mean, we've always known that. That was what it took in K through 3 to have children learn how to be ready to read and ready to do math and ready to move forward. And then all those proven strategies that we've been the best practices of for all these years, you know, have gone down the toilet. Our class size limits have been lifted. Our experienced educators are under attack, and no tenure. The teacher tenure has been stripped away. The vouchers in, teacher tenure and professionalism out. And so we've seen this as an extreme attack straight on, you know, our public education system. And, you know, where the voucher programs have been enacted in other states, what we've seen shortly, quickly, is that it has helped to economically and racially segregate our school. And, you know, with those who, if you underfund your schools, you take out your best teachers, you put 40 kids in a class, you don't have any, you know, you have these EBOS for your teacher effectiveness, it's based only on test scores. I mean, this is the perfect storm, and they have, you know, the hurricane has hit North Carolina, and it is devastating.
Now, is it, in your opinion, is it the racial component of resegregating? Is it the monetary, we want to make money off education? Is it the destruction of public education in favor of private, or is it all of the above?
Oh, it's all of the above. It always has been. But I think initially, over the last 3 or 4 years, we've been fighting this, and we're, you know, actually a decade we've been fighting Paul Stamm and his racist views towards, you know, our society and his views towards public education. He doesn't think the government should be in the business of public education. So this has been going on for a decade. They just didn't have the votes.
Hold on. Stop.
Yeah.
The business of public education?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, but I don't see it as a business. I see it as a common good. I see it as something for the good of our nation, almost as probably higher than national security, because if you don't have an educated, critical thinking electorate,
right,
you've got problems.
Right, exactly. So I'm just saying that for the last decade, we've been hearing that undercurrent of, you know, we need to privatize our schools because parents need to make decisions for the schools. We don't want sex education. We don't want someone teaching the Common Core. We don't want someone teaching things that we don't have control over. So this privatization movement has been somewhat based in racism and in religious doctrine. But then, lo and behold, the recession and ALEC brought us a reason to hide our racist views, our economically views that don't want to get poor on us and our kids. And they've used the recession as an opportunity to refocus and say, hey, schools aren't doing good. They're broken, aren't they? Let's fix them. And where can we fix them best? In the private sector, where we can, you know, we can feed at the trough of the public dollar.
Yeah.
So we have a lot of greedy, selfish little piggies here who are working very hard to feed at that trough. And so anything that has been deep-seated in terms of social justice issues, I think has really risen, what has risen to the top of the debate is here's another marketplace. Here's a place we can do online with no certified teachers. We can, are just now, they're going to send the money to private schools. Only 25% of the teachers have to be certified. My goodness.
Jeez.
Who would have ever thought that?
I got to be honest. You know, as you think this through and you look at the history of this, it shows to me what that segment of our population thinks of our kids, of our future, of families. You know, the same people who talk about family values and, oh, how much we care about the children and we want to promote family values.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
that has been the most evil and disingenuous thing that has happened, and I think it's shameful, and I think that, you know, that's how public schools first North Carolina got started. We realized several years ago that actually 4 years ago, we saw deep inroads in the General Assembly into the school voucher and the rural charter movement, and we saw very clearly the results of religious and private schools that take taxpayers' money were very, very, very quickly take over our public schools. In fact, in some rural communities, they've put in and disapproved these rural charters that will actually wipe out almost entire high schools in the community.
Jeez.
Okay, and these schools don't have the same accountability. You know, the public has been so worried about spending the public dollars, right? The Republicans have put in restriction after restriction after restriction. We got to have evaluation. We have to have EBOS. We have to have, you know, tenure. We have to have contract renewal. We have pushed down the teaching profession to control it. And now, guess what? All of a sudden, these rules don't matter to these folks in the General Assembly, the Republicans. And now they're willing to say, oh, you don't have to be accountable. So we're going to give you a check, and we don't really have to know how Bobby and Susie have done this year. Okay, and we don't have to really have certified teachers. Come on, we'll do Teach for America. You know, that'll hold us off for a couple years. We'll chase away the public education supporters, the good, solid middle class. And then our schools will certainly be have and have not schools. We'll have two school systems, one public, one private. This is absolutely one of the most devastating dismantling of public education and of our teaching profession in the nation. And our teachers are already have salaries 48th in the nation and per pupil 46. I mean, my goodness, we're almost at the bottom. Give us one more year of this voucher program. We'll be at the bottom.
Well, you could be number one. Number one
absolutely
to the bottom.
Number one will be the lowest, will be the place where no teacher will want to go in debt to get educated and certified, because you know what? You don't have to be certified. You can graduate in anything and go teach elementary kids.
Okay.
And so this is kind of where we are. And these attempts to privatize our public schools, the most disheartening thing is that the business community has stood idly by. You know, the fear of retaliation, the fear of revenge politics, the fear of, hey, I'm not going to get my, you know, my benefit. You know, we have so many little piggies at the trough in the General Assembly, so many lobbyists who are pushing for their own special interests. They're afraid to stand up to this GOP. And what it's left our poor children, our state, and our teachers, they've been abandoned.
Yeah,
they have no one that stands up for them, no one.
That's
and we're trying. We're trying. We're a group of volunteer moms and dads and grandparents and educators who are volunteering our time to try to organize our state to fight back against these extremely aggressive and undesirable programs.
And that's the reason we asked you on, because, you know, I think it's important that people in our listening area, that they see that activism is going on, and they see the battles, and they see the fights, and the hows and whats, because, you know, we're fighting the same kind of things here, Yvonne.
Well, we've got to keep at it, because, you know, honestly, the cornerstone of our country, and not to be sounding hokey, but honestly, why did we come to this country? Why did we discover this land? What were we seeking to do? Have religious freedom and the guaranteed right of education so we could be informed and we could be able to make decisions and to have a democracy. It is the cornerstone. And, you know, the only way I was able to lift myself up out of poverty and low income, you know, low middle class life was to be the first person in my family to go to school. And when I got there, they had to take me. And when I got there, they were responsible for making sure I could read and I could write and I could go to college. We're taking that away. And the people who will be the most disadvantaged are low-income minority children. And that is what is being attacked here. The very foundation of our economy and all the children that are moving forward are Latinos, Hispanics, the poor. I think you can tell I'm just flabbergasted and deep grief over what's happening to our public schools.
I got to be honest with you. Your reaction is what I would hope every person listening to this. That's the reaction I want from everyone. The frustration, the anger. You know, we're continually told our schools are broken, and I'm going, well, you know, how many of them are broken? Well, a very small percentage. Even in the most liberal definition of broken, only a handful. So then, why don't we fix those instead of destroying the whole system?
Absolutely.
There should be people in the streets constantly because, as you pointed out, myself included. The road out of poverty is with education, and not by restricting it and not by profiting from it, because I truly believe education is a common good right up there with our national security and the rest.
I think if we think about every day what are the two things that probably enrich and make our lives, it is the ability to have our own religious beliefs, some or none, by the way, and to have the right to attend a public university in a public K-12 school. And when that is no longer available, or if it is so undesirable that it is a second-class education, then everyone should be concerned. Everyone who ever has a child in the system, everyone who ever wants to hire someone who's a product of the system, everyone who wants to see economic and social vitality in their cities and their communities, because that's what is at stake. The heart and soul of our democracy, to me, and I care deeply about many, many rights, but the right to a basic education is on the top of my list, because I'm telling you that is a way to keep and suppress people who are not like you, to keep people who are poor, to keep people of color down, so they don't get in your way and they don't get in your boardroom and they're not your CEO. I think that this has been a boom, win-win-win for the Republicans, because they get to express their desires for care so much about the poor kids, to make money for, you know, their companies who want to rush in and offer charter schools and online schools, and they get to hide their racism and their absolutely disdain for people who are poor, because that, to me, is what it's all about. I want to get my kids out of that school. You've convinced me they're broken. I'm moving my kid out. I'll take my voucher or not, and I'll go to my charter school. I'll go to my private school, and then I'll leave everybody else behind. Those children who have very little resources for advocacy in their home. But America, North Carolinians, please do not let this be the legacy of the century. Do not let this be the legacy of this decade. You know, that we are going to let our children, you know, and how about this? How about separation of church and state? Who cares about that? I mean, you know, another principle in which, you know, our vouchers don't do that. Vouchers now are taking your tax dollars and giving it to a church school. Wiccan, the Wiccan School of Raleigh could certainly qualify. Any church, any religion can qualify. And that, you know, is absolutely a violation, in my view, of taking our tax dollars and using them for the public good.
So here, that argument's been made a number of times, that it's unconstitutional to use tax dollars for education. Do you have a similar thing in the North Carolina Constitution?
Well, the North Carolina Constitution is beautiful, because what it says is that every child has the right to a sound basic education. It almost echoes and mirrors to the federal constitution. And so it is one of the strongest state constitutions ever. I mean, that's one of the reasons I want to live here, right? This is a state that in its constitution says that we guarantee this. Now, these clowns are saying, oh, we're doing that. And in fact, we're expanding opportunities. Now we're going to give vouchers to poor children. But, of course, we know that in every state, that's how they started, and you know, with restrictions on who got vouchers. And then, you know, 4 or 5 months later, there was some extra money. They lifted the cap. They raised the bar. You know, you can have less money. And pretty soon, they kowtow to, hey, I'm paying taxes. I want my voucher. So then we have the Trinity Christian Church gets, you know, their voucher for their school, and on and on and on. And the thing that's really deplorable is that, you know, nothing, not one single study has shown that being in these voucher schools or charter schools improves education for children.
Well, in fact, In fact, the Stanford study actually showed that the charter schools, and especially the cyber charters, were actually worse.
Right. So we have underfunded schools. We're going to take more. It'll segregate our children economically and racially. It will absolutely take away local control and local costs from local school boards, because they've made all the decisions here at the state house, so to speak. and it leaves behind the children who have the greatest need. It violates church and state. There's no accountability. And these, quote, opportunity scholarships out of the Alex playbook are despicable, and it is shameful. And the only way that I know that we can fight back is to stop, you know, start exposing those people who are supported by Alex, start exposing those companies who pay their big fat dues into Alex, and to lobby at the local level, the state level, for every single citizen to say, this isn't fair, this is shameful, this will undermine our social justice, it will undermine our cultural activities in our city and camp towns. And it will absolutely destroy our economic viability.
And it's bad for business.
I can't imagine that's a business. What company is listening right now? And once, you know, we just finished the 12th war on Monday. I just left. I'm sitting outside the jail as I talk to you. 70 more people were arrested. And most of them, you know, like me, in the latter parts of their life. Because we've spent 30 and 40 years of our life fighting against these very things. And now I actually thought up until a few years ago that I was going to be leaving a legacy, a progressive legacy to my grandchildren. And now I don't see that. It is extremely depressing. We can't redraw the districts down here in North Carolina. So the census, which is 2020. And then a year after that, we have 8 years of literally being enslaved to this Republican organization, unless we can get people in this district to wake up and start participating in their democracy, demanding rights for every child. And so that's the hope. And I hope that people are listening to your show and they understand and go to publicschoolsfirstnc.org. We got a ton of materials on there. We have a lot of information and research, and we need help. We need advice. You know, other states, give us your advice. Other people who fought this battle, whether you won or lost, tell us how to avoid problems, because we are not backing down. We are going to fight, fight, fight. And, you know, I'm 63 years old, and I am going to spend the rest of my life making sure that every child has a sound basic education, regardless of race and gender, regardless of their income, and regardless of where they live, because that's what my Constitution says these children deserve.
Good on you, Yvonne. Good on you. And the website, publicschoolsfirstnc.org. We've got a link at therickSmithShow.com.
And if you send me info at publicschoolsnc.org, if you send me or ybrand@gmail, I will help you in any way I can. I'll answer your emails. info@publicschoolsnc.org.
And we'll make sure we get links at therickSmithShow.com. Just click on Yvonne Brannon's name. It'll take you right there. Yvonne, it was great talking with you.
Great talking to you, and any time.
I look forward to talking to you again then. Terrific.
Okay.
Thanks
all
so
right.
much.
Thank you, sir.
You know, you look at the Pennsylvania Constitution, and as Yvonne brought up, in the North Carolina Constitution, it gives the right of education. Well, in the Pennsylvania Constitution, pretty simply, it states in Section 14 under public school system, the General Assembly shall provide for the maintenance and support of a thorough and efficient system of public education to serve the needs of the Commonwealth. It also goes on to say in Section 15, no money raised for the support of the public schools of the Commonwealth shall be appropriated to or used for the support of any sectarian school. No religious money. No privatization, in my view. The people who wrote this document kind of got it. You need to have a public education where everyone has equal access. Equal opportunity. And I know those are becoming evil words. Equal opportunity, because that's for those urbans and those poors. No, it's for everybody. You know, and I look at this situation in North Carolina, where they're moving full steam ahead, systematically dismantling public education, as they're doing here, and as they're doing in a lot of places. This voucher, this has been a sustained movement for over a generation now. The billionaires who think years into the future, they put money into these things. You know, we were talking earlier with Kevin Boyle, and he said, you know, I wish more wish people would get a little more radical. I wish people would push things a little further. The right does this. The radical right doesn't. You know, remember the push during the Bush years of, he actually won re-election. He won election the second time. Went after Social Security. Got beaten badly under the privatization and cutting and all of that. Now they're talking about, hey, well, we can move the bar, change CPI, move that a little bit. See, the right understands throwing that trial balloon out there and taking a beating for it if they have to, sacrificing a couple of people that they'll take care of, but it's about pushing the goalposts. It's about going further and further. And even if they're bad ideas, we're still putting ideas in your head. 20 years ago, the thought of the voucher program in most areas unthinkable. But they have done their best work in demonizing, as Yvonne pointed out, demonizing teachers, demonizing the local schools. And I can't tell you how many times I've heard it. Well, when I went to school, things were much more better. They were much more difficult than me. Blah, 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 blah. Kids today, the teachers are this, blah, 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 blah. And they get away with it. Because they don't know. And, you know, I got this thought that most people just want to be, you know, in with the crowd. Yeah, you know, I agree with you. Things weren't tough back then. It was a lot harder on me, but I forged through. School is just too easy today. The money is where I tend to look. Look at all of the money that these business people, and Yvonne pointed to it. The legislator down there says that the state shouldn't be in the business of educating people. The business. And I mean, if you listen to their rhetoric, they're very open and very honest. There's nothing that we should be doing for ourselves. Everything should be done with a profit motive. Everything should be done so they can put more money in their pockets. I mean, the reality is education is a huge cash cow because a lot of constitutions are like Pennsylvania's, are like North Carolina's, in that you got to do it. You got to educate every kid. Now, what our Constitution doesn't really say is it has to be equal. I mean, you know, support a thorough and efficient system. Serve the needs of the Commonwealth. I don't see anything about saying all that equal, though, which is how you get away with having a Chester Upland school district where the teachers work for free for a month because they gave the money to the charter operator. Just a thought. We got a lot of work to do and a lot of organizing and a lot of boots in the street, folks. But, you know, we've been in bad places before and we've always fought back. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, therickSmithShow.com, questions, comments, whatever's on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com, or give us a call here at the studio, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Back with Hour 3.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
In Washington, D.C. Monday, American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten called on educators to join with parents and community partners nationwide to reclaim the promise of public education. She said a new poll shows parents overwhelmingly want to see strong public schools rather than charter schools, and she says parents trust and respect teachers more than the politicians and CEOs who are attacking teachers and their unions.
What parents are telling us is, wait a second, actually trust the people who are closest to our kids. Don't fire them. Turn around struggling schools and stabilize our neighborhoods. Don't close them. Parents very much want our bosses and public officials to work with teacher unions, not to keep the fight up. Parents want high-quality public schools.
Weingarten says 1 in 2 public school students are impoverished. She says the American Federation of Teachers is using solution-driven unionism to make sure that teachers are prepared to meet high standards. Weingarten says the promise of a great public education is under assault by those who, for ideological reasons, want to call public education a failure. She says communities and teachers must join forces nationwide to fix, not close, struggling schools. Michigan's Republican governor is appealing, but a county court in Michigan has agreed with AFSCME that Detroit's bankruptcy filing violates Michigan's state constitution by threatening to cut pension benefits. AFSCME President Lee Saunders says neither Michigan Governor Rick Snyder nor Detroit Emergency Financial Manager Kevin Orr are above the law. The county judge ruled that the emergency manager should immediately withdraw the bankruptcy petition and should not authorize any further bankruptcy filings that threaten to diminish or impair accrued pension benefits. AFSCME says Detroit's public workers get an average pension of less than $18,000 a year, and it's both illegal and unfair to cut them. The public is still finding out details regarding the fallout from a 2011 nuclear power plant meltdown in Japan. Jesse Russell reports.
10% of the emergency workers at the Fukushima nuclear plant in Japan were doused with enough radiation to potentially develop thyroid cancer. Tokyo Electric Power said last week that 1,973 emergency workers were hit with what is considered to be the tipping point of exposure by doctors. In March of 2011, reactors of the plant began to melt down due to an earthquake and tsunami. More than 18,000 died during the natural disaster that brought on the meltdown, and tens of thousands had to evacuate due to the radiation threat. This week, the company admitted that radioactive waste has likely been leaking into the sea ever since the disaster.
Workers at an Ontario-based Coca-Cola plant have ended a strike after 3 weeks. The workers are represented by the Canadian Auto Workers and returned to work following a vote in favor of a new 3-year contract. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
They believe in teachers' unions. We believe in teachers.
What they do is not in your face.
All the time they want to take your place, the backstabbers.
Backstabbers.
1-888-520 Rick. 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. I was looking at this article over at The Hill that said that, and this is one of those things that just blows my mind. And it's one of those things where, you know, as a parent, you tell your kids to do the right things, you know, behave, tell the truth, be honest, be forthright, you know, be a decent person, say what you're going to do, what you say you're going to do, and you know, all that, blah, 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 you know, down the line. And you'll be rewarded. You say, you know, if you as any parents, your parents did, as my parents did, you do the right things, you do what you're supposed to do, you'll be okay. You work hard, you play by the rules, all of that, you'll be fine, you'll do well. I look at the Republicans, who have done everything that they could possibly do to gunk up the system. They've done everything they can possibly do to gum things up, to destroy what has been built. All of the policy, all of the discussion, all of, you name it, the hostage situation, after hostage situation. So you had John Boehner on the Sunday Talking Head shows. And he's asked about, you know, look, he says, you know, the guy goes, you know, one of the most ineffective Congresses in history. They've got the lowest approval rating. They've been the least productive. Nothing's gotten done. And Boehner goes and says, well, you know, don't judge us on how many laws we passed. Judge us on how many we repeal. Huh? Because it goes back to their belief system that all regulations are bad. Job killers. So for the money that we've paid Congress, you go through and you go, okay, what have they done? What has the Republican-led House of Representatives done? Well, they've repealed Obamacare. They've repealed the health care about 40, 50, maybe 65 times, depending on, but at least 40 is upwards of 65. So you go, okay, well, they did that. To me, that's not a positive. that's actually a negative. You're actually taking health care away from people and making poverty worse. And I'm putting all of this through the frame of Representative Reed's poverty search, if you will, their big listening tour. I put it through that frame going, okay, well, what makes poverty better? What makes poverty worse? What pulls people out of poverty? What pushes them in? Healthcare is something that helps people out of poverty. We know that. So by saying we're going to repeal it 40 to 65 times, to me, that's saying, well, we're going to make poverty worse. And you go down the list, some of the repeals on elections, part of the, on clean and fair elections, the home affordability and modification program that the Republicans voted in 2011 to repeal, that would have helped people stay in their homes. I think that would have been something to help. And you go down the list, stuff on the tax codes, Dodd-Frank, the estate tax, student loan reforms, right down the list of all the things that they've repealed that I think actually make poverty worse. So if you look at the frame of, we're going to solve poverty, you're going to do that by making it worse? And, I go back and I think about Representative Reed's, opportunity, empowering opportunity, which for me, I go back to the very first thing I said about Obama when he took office. My one wish for him was to save the reward of work, which to me means, one, you got to raise the minimum wage. It's ridiculous. It's insane to me that a minimum wage is a poverty wage. Sorry, I just think it's absolutely insane that I'm going to work an entire year, 40 hours a week, 52 weeks, the entire year, and I'm going to be well below the poverty line. That makes no sense whatsoever. And even the McDonald's people, when they and Visa came together for their website to help those poors, the urbans, those workers budget, actually had the budget for a second full-time job. You've got McDonald's, one of the biggest low-wage employers in the country, saying, we know you can't make it on what we pay in 40 hours a week. You got to go out and get a job working 35 more. Think of that. So for me, you want to alleviate poverty? It's pretty simple. Expand Medicaid. Get people insurance. Make sure that they're not on the brink of economic collapse because of one illness. Raise the minimum wage so that we put an incentive and a reward to work. Expand educational opportunities, be it pre-K, be it K through 12, be it higher ed, be it vocational training. Education should be something that everyone can access and not be saddled with massive debt. Reinstate some of the funding that we've gutted from assistance programs. Bring back the general assistance budget. Bring back some of the health and human services spendings that have been gutted in every state across this country. One of my other ones is stop calling people names. Stop the blame game. Stop saying you're poor because you're lazy or you're stupid or you're unemployed because, you get fat and happy on that unemployment. We know you do drugs. Like our governor said. And for me, the biggest one of all, a jobs plan. We heard Kevin Boyle earlier in the day saying that he thinks in the fall, they're going to pass a transportation bill. In the fall. And why do I keep emphasizing in the fall? Well, because it's the fall. And that means it's followed by winter, which is not a construction season. We have lost another construction season. So we could be putting people back to work right now. Jobs. Remember? 2010, Laser Lake Focus, jobs. Remember? We could have started some of those programs, but no. Not so much. Not going to do. Because the system is gunked up. And I look at this and I go, okay, so we have rewarded, again, the bad people with rewards. Because I see this article over at The Hill, and it says that there's a chance that the Republicans could take the Senate. And right now, Democrats hold a 54-46 majority in the Senate. Two of the 54 are independents, Bernie Sanders and Angus King. King, I'm not so sure, is a Democrat. I think he's flexible. So you look at 53, you lose three seats. You make Angus King the most powerful man in the country because he can flip control one way or the other. And they're saying it's very possible when you look at Montana, you look at South Dakota, and you look at West Virginia, which it seems that the Democrats are going to struggle with. And now that Schweitzer, former Governor Brian Schweitzer of Montana, has pulled out to replace Max Baucus, who, thank goodness, he's going. I mean, if you're going to get someone insane, you might as well have someone certifiably insane. It looks like they're probably going to lose Montana, and it's possible, it seems actually likely, that South Dakota and West Virginia will go as Rockefeller, his replacement, whoever's going to run for his seat, will probably be a Republican and win, which just blows my mind. I mean, just absolutely blows my mind. So you're looking right there at, three more seats. So you're looking at a 51-49. You throw in King, who I keep saying, you never know, makes it a 50-50. We're still okay. But then you throw in Iowa, where Tom Harkin's retirement could be that vacancy that makes Angus King the most powerful guy in the Senate, because he flips to be a Republican, because, as I understand it, I think he was a Republican in Maine when he was governor. You now have a Republican-controlled Senate along with a Republican-controlled House. Now, the Democrats, I've been saying this for a while, they're going to be vulnerable to losing the Senate anyway, because you've got a bunch of Democrats up and only a handful of Republicans up for re-election. Now, some of these people who are up for re-election, like Arkansas's Mark Pryor or Alaska's Mark Begich, not big fans of either one of those. Also not fond of Mary Landrieu, not fond of Kay Hagan, but we'll see. Republicans, very few people that they consider are in the hot seat. So the Democrats have a lot of defending to do. And what blows my mind is you look at what they've actually done. It's nothing but obstruction and delay. It's nothing but gumming up the system, and they're going to benefit from that. And that's what ticks me off. The other part that ticks me off is the Democrats that the options that you're given aren't even that great of options. And I look at New Jersey, where it's probably assured that a Democrat's going to hold that New Jersey seat vacated by the death of Frank Lautenberg. But Cory Booker seems to be the big guy, and he's getting he's getting the big money, as Steven Spielberg and David Geffen evidently just had a big check they wrote to him. Ivana Trump has hosted a fundraiser. All of this money going into what I think is just a bad, bad candidate. I mean, we can do much better. I like Rush Holt. I don't think he stands a chance, but I like him. But it doesn't seem, I don't know, bad choice or horrible choice. I fear we're going to end up with a Republican-controlled Senate, which would be, I think, disastrous. Entertaining from a talk show perspective, but disastrous from a democracy perspective. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. It's desperate times, so desperate measures we explore. Marching on the Capitol to lobby leaders for involvement. 3,000 people screaming out, where's our government? Lawsuits and arraignments, members under company surveillance. Public divided, either they love us or they hate us. Rock millions off our back, and it's still not enough. They should have spoken to a cap, but we never give up. We'll be here one day longer. One day longer.
radio experience. Where hard work, common sense, and rational thought are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
One thing I've come to value in the last couple of years is the altruism and keen economic insights of the fourth richest man in America, Charles Koch. Even though Koch was raised rich and has now amassed a personal fortune of about $34 billion, he recently gave us a deeper sense of his true worth, measured not in dollars but in values. We want to do a better job of raising up the disadvantaged and the poorest in this country, he declared. Excellent thought. FDR couldn't have put it better. Noting that a big problem for the poor is that the powers that be, quote, keep throwing obstacles in their way, Koch cut to the chase, saying, we've got to clear those out. Yes, Charlie, I'm with you. Clear out such barriers as the offshoring of middle-class jobs, union-busting, poorly funded schools, and the lack of affordable health care, housing, and child care. Good God, no, barked Koch. It turns out that he intends to help poor people by eliminating, ready, the minimum wage. Why? Because, explains this clueless son of the rich, having a wage floor, quote, reduces the mobility of labor. In case you don't dwell in the plutocratic, narcissistic, Ayn Randian fantasy land where the Kochs hang out, labor mobility is right-wing psychobabble for social Darwinism. Remove all remnants of America's economic safety net, they coldly theorize, while wallowing in their nests of luxury, and the poor will be freed to become billionaires. As Charles puts it, with no protections, the disadvantaged would have to scramble just to live, thus freeing them to, quote, start a business, drive a taxicab, become a hairdresser. This is Jim Hightower saying, what a visionary he is. Where you see massive debilitating poverty, he sees a brave new world with millions of billionaire hairdressers. And the Kochs wonder why they're considered kooks.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Rebuilding America. It's Manufacturing Monday.
Hello, Detroit. Auto worker, let me thank you for your time. You work a 40-hour week for a living. Just to send it all down the line.
All right, look at what's going on in Detroit. And, you know, it's just an absolute... It's an absolute shame, and really it's the highlight of our insane trade policies and deindustrialization over the years, as we've given away our wealth and really abandoned our what used to be called, you know, and I think about this, the arsenal of democracy, because it was that manufacturing capacity that built our war machine, and it's just it's an absolute shame. And I don't know if you watched the Talking Heads yesterday. It was like Tough Love Sunday. As you had Rick Snyder, the governor, there saying, well, you know, we're not going to bail them out. We're not going to ask the federal government. Screw those people in Detroit. They deserve it. Basically, they deserve it. It's insane. And I'm telling you, what's going on there, that's the litmus test. What's going to happen here? You look at what our governor, what our legislature has been doing, and, boy, a lot of the same insanity. Anyway, let's go to the phone lines. Got Jake, my buddy Jake, on line one. Jake, how are we doing today, brother?
Hey, good, Rick. Welcome back.
Yeah, it was a long, long trip, but it was a fantastic trip.
I understand it was, but while you were gone, there were some interesting things that happened. You talk about our governor. Behind the scenes, there's some interesting things happened. when we talk about some key issues like privatization and we talk about Medicaid expansion. On privatization, while you were gone, it had appeared in June that there wasn't going to be anything that was going to really stick. It looked like they were going to go into the recess, nothing being done. There was a proposal by Senator McEnany back in May, which would have long-term meant the end of the LCB stores, although initially it kept those stores and its wholesale distribution system in place, but it would have offered up to 14,000 holders of existing beer licenses the right to sell wine and spirits. Now, obviously, with 14,000 of them out per prospective businesses cutting into the profits of the wine and spirit shops, it doesn't take a genius to figure out that at some point those wine and spirit shops are not going to become profitable and that they would eventually been closed down. Fortunately for those of us who oppose privatization, that didn't happen. So coming into late June, we thought that nothing was going to happen. Don't you know, I call it the Friday night massacre. The Republicans late at night actually, when I say late at night, it was after midnight. They actually had to suspend the rules. They apparently late in the day made a last concerted effort to appease what I call some of the Republican senators who didn't agree with them on privatization. My state senator, Senator Falmer, up until several hours before he changed his vote around 10 o'clock, had been a no vote.
Arm twisting.
And when I got a phone call, I immediately called up, and I was told that, well, the beer distributors agreed with him. Now, why they would do that, I want to go into that a little bit later, but why they would agree with him, I don't know. But he switched his vote. You have guys like Greenleaf and Tomlinson, and if you know anything about their record, they are moderate Republicans. Now, the next day they came out and said, Rick, that even though we voted for this, you can't count on our vote in the final when the final bill comes up for a vote.
Right.
Then you have Senator White from Indiana. I mean, this guy, wow. You talk about strange. The next day he had a press conference and he said, and I quote, I know that this bill, being the privatization bill, is going to hurt my area. And I don't know that this is tied to transportation, but just in case it is, I'm going to vote for it. So what does that tell you? That tells you that a little birdie was in his ear. I think what happened.
There was no birdie in his ear. There was somebody grabbing his arm and twisting around his back.
I think at the end, and Senator Gortner, too, from Columbia, I think what they said to a couple of these guys, you need to take one for the Gipper being the governor, and I'll tell you why I think that, Rick. The next day, the governor's office came out firing all cylinders. We were successful in bringing privatization getting privatization through the Senate. Well, they were this time, but when you look at their support, it's tenuous. I do believe there's some arm twisting. Just some of the public statements, I think the closer you get to the election, I think there's going to be a real reticence in some of these Republicans to maybe not support it. Now, you look at the provisions, the beer distributors. Yes, now they can sell under this bill. They can sell wine and spirits, but they're going to have to compete with the wine and spirit shops. What does that mean, Rick? That means a large investment, enlargement of your company. You're going to have an adequate choice when consumers come into your store. That means investment in an awful lot of money. Are they going to be able to do that? Remember, this is going to cost, these are small businesses, it's going to cost them $8,000. And even when the wine and spirit shops, and by the way, there was some pretty onerous language, it provides that these wine and spirit shops in each individual counties will have 6 months to shut down when there are twice as many businesses who bought these licenses. When there's twice as many businesses, when you compare it to wine and spirit shops within that particular county, when that threshold is met, all the wine and spirit shops in that particular county are going to have to shut down. I would guess in my county that's within 2 years. So what's going to happen when they shut down? If there's not enough supply, you know what's going to happen, Rick? And here's the irony. You're going to have people in central Pennsylvania and York County who are very close to the border. They're going to go to Maryland. The people in Philadelphia, you've been down there. It's right across the bridge. And you're literally, once you're across the bridge, you are 1 mile to the east. You're in New Jersey. Once you're across the bridge, you're in Delaware. What you're going to develop is more border bleed, which they say they don't want. And I think the real problem that the Republicans have, every time they reconfigure the wealth in the wine and spirits industry, what they're doing is just taking from one and giving to the other. And I think they got a real problem here.
But isn't that what they say? Isn't that the problem now, though? Everyone's leaving the state. The border bleed's already happening. Isn't that what they're saying the privatization's supposed to alleviate, that there'll be more access here so people don't have to leave the state?
Well, when you look at that, let me ask you something. Let's just say for the moment that there is some. Do you think it's going to decrease or increase when the supply dries up? And that's what's going to happen. I think the beer distributors, if they agree with this, and by the way, the state organization poses it, I think what they're signing is their own death warrant, Rick.
I think the beer distributors are screwed in this deal because
absolutely.
I think they're going to be beer. There'll be six packs everywhere, which will put them out of business. And then, you know what? You know, the good medicine is that they get what they deserve. At the end of the day, though, for me, I don't know that I really want to have that kind of saturation.
No, you don't. I mean, this bill allows grocery stores to sell wine and spirits, and the law says, and this is the way it's written, they can buy up to 3 6 packs or a 6 pack and a 12 pack. I mean, that's the way it's written. Beer distributorships, of course, they can sell them now in quantities less than a case, which is what package reformulation is what some of these people wanted. But that's really not the problem. Oh, and by the way, listen to this. Under this provision, Pennsylvania breweries can also sell at farmers markets.
Nice.
I mean, they're trying to take care of everybody.
No, you know.
I mean, I think the Republicans have overstepped their mark on this one, Rick. I really do.
But what we need to do is
keep pressure. Call your senators. Even call your rep, even though they might have supported it. Call them. I think we can win this battle. Now, the other issue.
Well, hold on. At the end of it, the bottom line to this whole privatization of the wine and spirit shops to me is very simple. It's about the money. It's about the huge, massive ripoff that's going on and the $500 million in tax dollars. All that other stuff is ancillary. To me, it comes down to dollars and cents. And the revenue, to me, is just too important to give up. I'm sorry. It's too much mm-hmm. money. It's just too much.
And by the way, our buddy Senator Furlow's got the right idea. Modernization, improve the access, use the mail, have the stores open more often, maybe reduce the price of the wine that has the most sales. I think that all makes perfect sense. That should be the way to go.
No, there you go. What else was going on while we were gone?
Well, one other issue quick, and I'll try to get through this. I know we have limited time. Medicaid expansion, of all the things that this administration, Rick, has done that don't make a lot of sense and I think are go against the mainstream political thought, this is one issue that doesn't make sense from a political standpoint, a practical standpoint, or a moral standpoint. Now, here we have Medicaid expansion. Each state has a right, thanks to the courts, now has the right to decide if they want to accept it. We're talking $6 billion a year. We're talking $43.4 billion a year. And the governor says, one, he says, I don't like the way hospitals are being treated, even though Hospital Association has said, we want you to accept it. There was testimony on the Hill while you were gone, Rick. Small rural hospitals testified, one after the other, that right now there's costs built into their hospitals right now that have direct relationship to Medicaid expansion. And if the governor doesn't accept the money, those expenses are still going to be there. And if he doesn't accept the money, they're going to have to dramatically cut back in their services. And in some instances, they're going to have to shut their doors. These are poor rural hospitals. Now, what does this governor propose? When you're from a poor rural area, you might only have one hospital. What do you propose if that hospital shuts down?
Don't get sick.
You're not going to have residents that might have to go 50, 60 miles to a hospital.
No, don't
get
sick.
That's absurd.
Don't get sick.
Well, another complaint, the governor, as you know, Rick, under this proposal, 44,000 children, Pennsylvania children, are going to be taken off CHIPS, which is the Pennsylvania program to cover poor children with health care. The governor doesn't like that. Well, there's a simple reason it's done that way. It's better care under Medicaid expansion. And here's another thing. I think these conservatives are missing the boat on this. The reason that the Health Care Reform Act uses Medicaid expansion as, you know, instead of using the regular interchanges, exchanges, the reason they're doing that, it's cheaper to cover them under Medicaid because the exchanges have added cost. In other words, what they're doing here, Rick, is making maximum use of tax dollars, which the Republicans say they're for. Now, why wouldn't they accept that? Then we're talking about there's estimates of up to 40,000 new jobs being created in the healthcare industry. Oh, and the other complaint is the governor, and this doesn't make sense either. They're saying that in the year 2020, when the federal government ceases to cover it all, they're going to be down to 90%, that's an unfunded mandate. Well, first of all, you're going to have that $6 million economic impetus every year. You're going to be covering costs to the hospitals that are going to fall back on taxpayers of Pennsylvania anyway. But the real solution is one of two. Either the Republicans put more money on the table, and I'm talking about closing the Delaware loophole, I'm talking about increasing the extraction tax, either put more money on the table for problems like health care, or we need a new governor. I suggest that we need a new governor in 2014. We need a governor that understands how important health care reform act is and the Medicaid expansion.
Well, we need a new governor, and I think the Republicans would agree, which is why we've been seeing the trial balloons being floated about possible replacements.
Yep.
I mean,
but
that's...
it just doesn't make sense why this governor would oppose that. It just makes no sense at all. I'm in a quandary, Rick. If you have the answer, let me know on that one.
Simple. Ideology. Blind faith ideology. Doesn't get any simpler than that.
I mean, I think that this is just another issue that's going to cost the governor a re-election, hopefully in 2014. And then one quick issue, transportation. The problem here is the conservatives in the House. They only want 1.7. The Senate passed the bill 2.5. I mean, I don't know what the problem is in the House. The governor's own commission said that we need $2.5 billion for the next 5 years. I understand why they're doing it. I disagree with them. The Republicans are opposed to adding a 25 to 30 cent add-on to each gallon of gas sold in the state. I understand that. They're also opposed to that $100 fee tacked on to anybody that's caught speeding. Again, my reply is, either put more money up front, or what you do, it's a user's fee. The user's fee isn't always the right way to go, but in this situation, that's the only thing that's left. I mean, the Secretary of Transportation has said, some of these bridges better be repaired pretty quickly, or we're going to put weight limits on it, which is definitely an economic impediment, and you don't want to go there.
I'm with you. All righty. Well, good. I'm glad you caught us up on that. Appreciate the time, man.
All right, Rick. Thanks for your time.
Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people on the talk.
Now, who'd have thought that after all, something as simple as rock and roll would save us all? Now, who'd have thought that after all, it was rock and roll?
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children. AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick, at thericksmithshow.com. So, a boy, I guess. It's a boy. Hooray. My wife was, oh, baby. Yay. Yeah, like, okay, great, baby. Let's find out what's going on around the world other than the baby. I'm going to talk with Justin Duckham, Talk Radio News Service. Justin, what do you think? It's a boy. Hooray.
It is a boy, and there is absolutely nothing else to talk about ever. This is the end-all, be-all of news, and if society continues to function beyond today, I will be surprised.
Yeah, I mean, it's just the end. The one thing that I've focused on, yeah, babies are cute and all that, I love babies, I've had three of my own, is the fact that the father there, the prince, mm-hmm. he's going to get paid leave for a couple of weeks. So that, you know, when I talk about real family values, even the prince there gets to be home with his child, and it's paid for.
That is depressing. Thank you for ruining my night.
Now, is that he gets it and you don't? Because we can fix that.
Well, in the first place, I'm in no place to be a father. I am a grotesquely immature, irresponsible individual.
But well, I'm glad that you recognize that and you have chosen not to procreate. We've got far too many people in this world who don't realize that and then go on to be these parents.
Yeah, my mom tells me that all the time. She always tells me, thank you for not giving me grandkids. So there we go.
Terrific. But, yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that I think we can change in this country. We hear a lot of talk about family values. I hear it all the time from my conservative friends believe in family values. But yet when you actually throw out something that would be a family value, oh, no, can't do that.
Well, family values at this point essentially means no gays, according to the Republican Party. You know, if it was really about family values, we would not see Mark Sanford back in the, seat that he once had in the 90s. And we would not see Newt Gingrich being a realistic presidential candidate. So I think at this point, if it doesn't exclude gays, it's not really a family value.
That's a good way of looking at it.
Now that a lot of gays can get married, I guess they'll be able to divorce. So, you're going to have to eventually drop that.
No, I'm thrilled with the idea that they can get married because I've got a few lawyer friends who, say, hey, if they do anything, if they divorce at just the rate that heterosexuals divorce at, boy, the cash will come flowing in.
And, as somebody who worked in a law office when the economy collapsed, I kind of understand that. I know that divorces went down in 2009 because a lot of families just couldn't afford to get divorced. So the easy solution to that is have more people get married. And then see their lives unravel before their eyes.
And be able to profit from it. That is the American way.
Exactly.
That is the free market speaking right there, my friend.
All right.
Well, let's move along. Saw the big news about Detroit. Bankrupt. Screw those pensioners. Screw those retirees. Screw those city workers. Throw them all to the curb, right?
That's what it seems to be, the main message coming out of that. There is a hearing that was announced today that's going to be taking place on Wednesday. This is the official federal hearing. It was expedited at the request of the government. But there are quite a few people in the state who are not taking this lying down. The automobile workers and a lot of other, state employees are putting up the fact that, we don't necessarily really believe that Rick Snyder has the constitutional authority to sort of make this call when it comes to employee pensions and whatnot. They don't believe that he is able to approve of this without having some other, means step in. So it's going to be a pretty interesting case to see where this goes. But we certainly see some Republicans kind of using, bankruptcy and the way that so many, capitalists use it in the sense that it's going to be benefiting them, screwing over a lot of other people. And in the end is just another tool that Republicans are sort of employing to really take away a lot of the rights and the you know, things that are coming to state workers.
I'm glad you said that because it's exactly what I've been saying for the longest time. They're trying to do, and you heard it with George W. Bush. We're going to run government like a business. You hear it from our governor here. The idea is exactly that. They're going to do what business has been getting away with for at least a generation, probably two, of just saying, well, yeah, we're broke. We're gonna go into bankruptcy court and wipe aside all of those obligations that we have to our workers. And, well, tough love. That's it. Tough luck, buddy. You're on your own.
Exactly. And that's, one of the most disconcerting aspects about this.
Yeah. Did you watch Tough Love Sunday with the governor yesterday?
I did not, no.
No, we don't have any choice. There are no choices. We have no other option. The whole Tina argument, there's no alternative. We have to do this. We have to cut these workers. We have to screw them. And it's just tough love. We don't have a choice. And I'm going, but wait a second. We've always got choices. You've just chosen not to use all of the other ones that are possible.
And it's convenient to see who this hurts and who this does not. So there we go.
Yeah. So where does it go from here? So Wednesday, I guess, is the big hearing to see if it can go forward.
Exactly. You know, there are a lot of people who are pushing against this. It looks like, the federal court, to a certain extent, may be a little bit sympathetic to the argument, but nobody's exactly sure where this is going to be going. We do, have signs coming out of the federal government that there's not going to be a bailout for Detroit like we've seen in a lot of these other big, too big to fail institutions, even though Detroit really is an institution that is genuinely too big to fail when you consider the American economy. Nevertheless, no one's really sure how this is going to develop from here. So it's a very frustrating example for a lot of people, not just in Detroit, but those who kind of value the pensions of workers outside of it as well.
Yeah, I mean, because the billionaires have got to be looking at this going, okay, this is the litmus test. This is what happens. This is where we're going to go when Buffalo goes down, when here in Harrisburg they file bankruptcy, in Chicago or wherever else, because there are a lot of cities and a lot of states teetering on the edge because the federal government's walked away from them, basically, because we've got to have tax cuts, Justin. Got to have them.
Exactly. That's sort of the argument that has been going on for quite some time now. It's not really – this is essentially what we see from the post-policy Republican Party. These are not things that actually make sense. These are things that either win elections or fill the pockets of those who don't really need it as much, and it really is just a sad state of affairs.
Yeah, let's move along. We're going to be shutting down the government to block Obamacare. We're going to block down the Affordable Care Act so some 32 million people can't have access to health insurance. Is that what Mike Lee is saying?
That is what Senator Mike Lee is saying. And, of course, this is coming just one week after we had that big filibuster negotiation that Harry Reid hammered out, where Republicans were going to be more cooperative in order to avoid a lot of the, big crisis we've seen. Initially the agreement was he was going to be using the nuclear option only when it came to those who were nominated by the executive branch, to move forward from them, and that would clear the way for quite a few. Afterwards, when there was an agreement that was agreed upon, Reid said that there was a new feeling in the House. That seems to be relatively short-lived, however, when you look at what's going on right now, where we see not just Mike Lee, but a number of other congressional Republicans talking about the full-scale financial ruin of the U.S. with the failure to lift the debt ceiling in order to halt Obamacare, which is something that, of course, was passed by a Democratic majority in the Senate and the House, and was something that a lot of voters eventually voted in favor of when it came to the 2012 election.
Yeah. I look at this, and all of these hostage situations, the next one's coming up to raise the debt ceiling again. But all of this stuff, you talk about to my real conservative friends who talk about, we need certainty. And we heard a lot of that up until the 2012 election. We need certainty, because businesses can't grow without certainty. How about certainty that we're not going to shut the government down over the implementation of the Health Care Act? How about the certainty that we're going to pay our bills? That seems to me to be, something that they would want, right?
That certainly would make sense. And, when it comes to certainty, this is something that could be avoided relatively easily. This is no longer a debate over the, pretty sane issue of whether or not the U.S. should pay its debts. This has turned into a more of a partisan war game that Republicans have learned to employ. They are not arguing on the merits of whether or not the America should pay back its debt, but they are arguing on the merits of whether or not they should respect legislation that was passed through the democratic process, and they are using one of the most corrupt tools in the Senate that's available right now in order to do it, which is, of course, the filibuster.
Yeah. Let me ask you, last week there was the Senate passed a bill on the student loan situation, and I got to be honest, not in favor of it. I think it's a bad deal. I think it's a horrible thought, and it shows me just where we stand on investing the future. What's the latest on this so-called compromise?
Well, it looks like it's going to be coming to the Senate floor tomorrow. This is something that is relatively close to the conservative, legislation pushed forward through the House, which would tie the student interest rates to the 10-year Treasury bond rate, which would essentially would keep student loan rates from spiking up higher than they were initially planned to, but could still continue moving up to as far as 8%. We now have, a number of progressives in the Senate, including Senator Bernie Sanders, who came out today saying that the president should scuttle this agreement, and Elizabeth Warren, as well as some others in the upper chamber, really pushing back against this and saying that what instead is needed is a full force freeze in order to keep these student loan rates from, raising and really harming a good segment of the American population.
And, I agree with Elizabeth Warren. If you're going to lend money to banks at close to 0% interest, why can't we make that kind of a loan to the next generation? Why do we have to saddle them with market-based loans? And that's what I loved, in the debates of all this, because the Republicans say, we need to have market-based solutions. Well, market-based means screw the next generation so I can have short-term profit now.
Exactly. That's what it seems to look like in this debate. And it is a little refreshing to see that there are some progressive voices really coming out in favor of this issue. But nevertheless, this is something that has gained the support of quite a few Democrats, including Tom Harkin, and Harry Reid, who is going to be moving forward with this sometime this week as soon as tomorrow.
And I like Tom Harkin, but I think he's wrong. I mean, at the end of the day, this should be at the least a neutral bill. It should not be going to pay for the debt. Well, I mean, explain this to me. We're going to saddle the next generation with a massive amount of debt, and then we're going to say, oh, while you're doing that, we're going to pay off our debt. I mean, you want to talk about redistribution of wealth? That is literally stealing from the next generation to pay for the last.
Indeed. And, as soon as you talk about the steps taken by the Obama administration that are going to be saddling, younger Americans with debt for decades, when you look at Obamacare and whatnot, this is something that is, saddling a lot of Americans with debt right now as we speak. And it is it doesn't hold up to the rhetoric that we've seen from the right.
So what are your thoughts on the president's statement over the weekend that he could have been? I mean, I think he's kind of late on this because I said it immediately. I could have been Trayvon Martin. But what do you think of him coming out saying that he could have been, it could have been him 35 years ago?
I've been in D.C. for a good number of years, and I find myself, accustomed to really cynical thinking pretty frequently. My initial thoughts of this was a little bit frustrating when I thought, what does this actually do to help him? What is he gaining from this? And just was sort of, it sort of boggled my mind. And then I kind of had a guilty feeling that maybe he's actually speaking from his heart. Maybe he's actually saying something that is, deeper than a lot of the political discourse that we get. Yeah. And when I put it in that perspective, I, had a much more sympathetic feeling towards it and was, upon closer examination, was absolutely taken aback that he had the sort of gusto to come out and make such an important statement such as this, considering everything that's been going on. This, of course, has irritated a lot of right-wing conservatives, that's, of course, is nothing very surprising, considering we're going to see that kind of outrage, if the president goes as much as to scratch his ass or whatnot. I think it was a very poignant thing that he said, I think it actually may have come from the heart instead of, the best, most basic political interest, which we've seen him act in quite a few situations.
Yeah, and I found it interesting that John McCain came out on Sunday and said that, the Stand Your Ground laws may be something that needs to be reviewed. You think?
No, certainly true. And this has really given a lot of people some pretty important food for thought. This goes, you know, a lot deeper than a lot of people can say, but that is one issue that could really be solved right away, since this is sort of a nightmare scenario for Stand Your Ground come to life. And it really shows that this legislation has real-world consequences.
Yeah, but for me, I look at this, and I look at the Stand Your Ground laws, and I've been thinking about this, had a conversation over the weekend where, you know, you've got two people who are legally allowed to be in a particular place. Who gets to stand and who has to fall? Because what you're saying then is one person's right and one person's wrong, because if you stand your ground, they you can shoot them.
So you better buy a gun.
So you
that's
better,
the main message.
Maybe that's the messaging. I'm waiting for the NRA campaign on that.
Which is kind of funny, considering that they never, you know, made the argument that they made when they saw Newtown or whatnot, when they said that teachers should be armed. They never really came out and said that maybe Trayvon Martin should have had a gun. So that's pretty telling.
It is what it is. Justin, it's always great talking with you. Appreciate the update.
Thank you.
Justin Duckham, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
Earth. Sky.
We live in an island of stars called the Milky Way. And many know that our Milky Way is a spiral galaxy.
In fact, it's a barred spiral galaxy, which means that our galaxy probably has just two major spiral arms, plus a central bar that astronomers are only now beginning to understand. But where within this vast and intricate spiral structure do our Sun and its planets reside?
Our galaxy is about 100,000 light years wide, and we're about 25,000 light years from the center of the galaxy. It turns out we're not located in one of the Milky Way's two major spiral arms. Instead, we're located in a minor arm of the galaxy. Our local spiral arm is sometimes called Orion Arm.
Our local Orion Arm of the Milky Way is about 3,500 light years across and is approximately 10,000 light years long. Our Sun, the Earth, and all the other planets in our solar system reside within this Orion Arm. We're located close to the inner rim of this spiral arm, about halfway along its length.
The Orion Arm is named for the constellation Orion the Hunter, which is one of the most prominent constellations of Northern Hemisphere winter or Southern Hemisphere summer. That's why we see so many bright objects within the constellation Orion, because when we look at it, we're looking at our own local spiral arm. We have a picture of this at earthsky.org. Search for the words Orion Arm. I'm Michael Brennan.
And I'm Emily Howard. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast there at their website, or download the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. So, as we said, the baby hath cometh. The new prince, king, possibly in line. Our quote of the day comes from CNN's royal contributor Victoria Arbiter, who, you know, you go, I know how hard it is sometimes when you're trying to say things on the spot, and maybe I'm being in defense. Maybe this just slipped out, but she said after it was announced, it's a boy, hooray, yay, she got it right. She said, my first thought, I have to say, was this is how brilliant a royal Kate is. There are women throughout British royal family history that have panicked not being able to deliver a boy. And here we are. Kate did it first time. So does it mean, of course, the change in the next secession conversation is over for the next 30 years or so? But we're celebrating and thrilled that Kate had a healthy, bouncing baby boy. Couple of things, just quick. I don't know that Kate probably is very brilliant. Probably. Don't know that her brilliance had anything to do with it being a boy. Just a thought. And maybe someone will disagree. I don't know. Maybe. But the whole line of secession thing, that whole quote-unquote conversation, I think that was decided some point at the beginning of this year, right? The 2013 Secession to the Crown Act that they passed made it gender neutral, whoever the first child would be, boy or girl, in line for the throne. I guess they're still trying to figure out how to implement it. But, you know, it's expected to happen. So I'm just curious, you know, why the conversation is still part of it. Just, well. But you look at all of the time that they've spent on the baby watch, and I haven't really talked about it, don't really care. As I pointed out, Prince William will get paid maternity leave, something I wish our family values types would pursue. Now, I know, we've got the Family Medical Leave Act, Rick, and, you know, if you wanted to take time off, it's unpaid. Fortunately, I was able to do that. I was able to take, I think I took 7 weeks off with my eldest daughter, and I think it was 6 weeks off with each of the other two. Finances are tough. It should have been paid. And I've often said what we should be doing is we should run it through unemployment. Where, you know, if you, it's like just like being unemployed, but make it something that you go, okay, we're going to run it through the unemployment system. We're going to maybe charge an extra couple of bucks here or there to make sure that we insure people, because after all, it is an insurance plan. So that if you have a child, and because we are a family value society, right, that the fathers have a little bonding time. Or the mothers, depending on what the situation is. I'm a firm believer in that quote-unquote bonding time, because I think it's important. I think it's important to welcome the new baby into the world, figure out how to navigate those waters and the dynamics of the new family, because I believe wholeheartedly in family values, even if our Republicans talk about it but don't seem to really believe it. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, therickSmithShow.com. That's where you go to get the podcast, Stitcher on your smartphone, all of the ways that we put it out there. Any questions, comments, something I said got under your skin, made you think, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I will not be here tomorrow. Pat LaMarche is going to sit in, and I'll see you back here on Wednesday.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide flood beneath the sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous array. Democracy is coming.